belts. They're looking to Gene Simmons for inspiration for the future, and that means merchandising. They just did Death Punch lunchboxes, and now they're thinking film, toys, well, the sky's the limit.
Number one for the second week, here they are with Battle Boy. Born from Five Finger Death Punch, that's our number one song for the second straight week. That's it for us.
Stay connected all week. Follow us on Twitter. You can follow Nikki at Nikki6, and you can follow me at Carrie Casey.
And we'll see you next time.
Sideshow, Nikki6.
WRAF and WRAF HD1 Detroit.
Now,
this is Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. Or text the RIF at 4WRIF. That's 4974-3. Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
Oh, thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. And, I forgot my broadcast school lesson.
Do we go by those anymore?
I never went to broadcast school either. Did you? You didn't, did you?
Well, I did a four-year bachelor's degree in broadcast.
Because you're not in front of a big...
I'm supposed to be smarter than you.
Yes, you are. You're not talking to this big auditorium, so you're supposed to say, welcome to you. We're speaking directly to you.
Well, we are.
Not everyone.
We are.
Welcome everyone. You don't say welcome everyone, you say welcome.
Okay.
There
okay.
we go. We got
All
that
right.
settled.
Thanks, Peter.
All right. Welcome to WRIF's phone-in talk show. This is kind of creeping up on like half a century that this has been going on, right?
Which part?
Night Call.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah.
We'll be going into
44. Year 44. 248-544-WRIF is our phone number.
Yes, that is 248-544-9743.
And thank you to Debbie in Western Massachusetts who does our Facebook page. Did you look at that in the last hour or so? It is cranking. There is so much up there, including,
sure,
you know, I was thinking, ooh, I don't even have that up in front of me. There you go. Okay. That there's that photograph of you and me, and I thought, well, you know, isn't this a little showful? You know, isn't this a little...
What?
To put a big old photograph of you and me on there, you know, with about... it almost looks like a selfie, doesn't it?
Oh. This is what you do on Facebook, Peter.
Oh, really?
People like to have a glimpse into your life.
So I was thinking, I don't know whether anybody would like this or not, and this has got one of the higher numbers of likes, including, I don't know if he's listening, Tot Nguyen. Tot used to run... Did you ever go there with my wife and I to that Japanese restaurant on 12 Mile Road?
I never went that way. I went there. But you know what? That's not how you say it. It's Nguyen. That's how you say that last name. Nguyen.
Who's on first?
I'm telling you.
Nguyen what?
Some people call it Nguyen. It's Nguyen. It's pronounced Nguyen.
I'm calling it Nguyen.
Okay.
All right. No, Nguyen.
You wrong,
Nguyen.
Peter
yeah.
Werby. Remember the guy who used to call and tell you that?
Yeah, right. You know, I was thinking there's a great, I saw Johnny Evans, the great saxophone player with Detroit's Howling Diablos band, and they have a great song out called I may not be Mr. Right, but I'm Mr. Right Now.
Right on.
Isn't that a great thing? All right. You'd never know it, but this is a really serious show because there are serious issues confronting us. But maybe this isn't the most serious consideration, and maybe it is for some people. But I want to talk about the war on Xmas.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I mean, Fox News, they are talking about the war on Christmas. I'm concerned about the war on Xmas. I mean, these people are trying to inject religion into this maniacal consumer holiday. I mean, they're trying to make this profane holiday into a religious one.
Which it is, well...
Well, it was, maybe. I mean, Christ's Mass, but, I mean...
All I hear is more about what my friend's kids want for Christmas.
Well, yeah.
You know, it's not about... It's and how they don't want to go to church.
Well, I know. So they're trying to make the profane sacred. Let's keep the X in Xmas. And then the religious people, if they want to have Christmas, they can do it, you know.
Yeah.
And all power to them. But in the meantime, it's odd to me that, all kidding aside, why these people are so defensive of wanting to keep the Christ in Christmas or what have you, because it is such a non-religious holiday.
Well, explain yourself. I know what you mean, but...
Well, it's what you said. What is it about? It's about, at its best, it's about family. It's about coming together. It's about sharing meals. It's about light shows, pagan, you know, a lot of pagan stuff, lights, mm-hmm. and because it comes right at the time of the solstice and
yes.
all that. And but these folks are all bent out of shape because
people are saying
happy holidays. Yeah.
You know, I mean, how horrible to want to be inclusive of everybody. How awful, how mean and spiteful of us to want to be inclusive of people.
I actually don't care one way or another, to tell you the truth. I mean, being sort of facetious. You can see all this stuff about Xmas on my website, which is PeterWerbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. I mean, religious disputes always are, I mean, I never want to get in on those.
Well, you know, it can start with two people in a room having a dispute about it, and then it morphs, and all of a sudden, countries are fighting each other.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, there's somebody we know that when you say to them, Happy Holidays, that they say, it's Christmas!
You know what? I tell you, people say to me when I'm on the air during the day, they'll say, you know, Merry Christmas, and I just say thank you. You know, it's just to me, like...
I'll even say Merry Christmas back.
I just say thank you. I don't either. You know, it's just, to me, just not worth it. All the hullabaloo over it is quite silly, in my opinion.
Now, this Fox News host, Megyn Kelly, has made herself...
one of these porn stars.
Yeah, has made herself the center of a racial controversy, something, of course, they love to do at Fox. And then we're talking about them, and, you know, there's no publicity. Any publicity is good publicity, right? So
yeah,
we're giving it to them.
But still, I mean, I think once in a while it deserves, especially on this show, to be addressed because it is so absurd. And maybe we are reaching out to people who are Fox News followers and we're putting a different spin on what they're doing over there.
Well, she was responding to an article last Wednesday responding to an article in Slate by Alicia Harris, who wrote an article entitled Santa Claus Should Not Be a White Man Anymore. To me, which then I would click onto the next story because who cares?
Yeah.
But anyway, she said the popular news host told viewers of the Kelly file, when I saw the headline, I kind of laughed and said, oh, this is ridiculous. Yet another person claiming it's racist to have a white Santa Claus. And just, by the way, you kids watching at home, Santa Claus just is white. But this person is maybe just arguing that we should also have a black Santa. But, you know, Santa is what he is. So just so you know, blah, 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 blah.
Okay, what's her name?
Megyn Kelly.
Megyn Kelly, I've got a news alert for you. Santa Claus is a fictional character.
But he was a fictional European figure. God. But if people want to redefine Santa Claus in different racial characteristics, who cares?
Who cares?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why she cares. I don't know why the other person cares.
I've seen black Santas.
Yeah, so have I. And why wouldn't a white Santa be okay for Asian kids and black kids and whatever?
Yeah, once again, fictional character.
Yeah.
Can this porn star biatch on Fox News find something more important to talk about?
No, but she went even further in claiming that the historical figure of Jesus Christ was in fact Caucasian. And she said, just because it makes you feel uncomfortable doesn't mean it has to change, whatever that means. You know, I mean, Jesus was a white man too. Said he was an historical figure. That's a verifiable fact. I would challenge her on that there's not an incredible amount of evidence that there was, in fact, an historic Jesus. But let's just, for the sake of argument, say that that's okay. Where is it? I'm all of a sudden losing this here. Oh, yeah. Though there's little to no factual or scholarly work on the biblical figure's racial heritage. I mean, only racists could care about this,
yeah,
right?
For
one thing.
For sure.
A 2011 BBC documentary called The Son of God attempted to create a modern composite of what Jesus might have looked like. I've seen these before. He's probably like 5'2" or 5'3".
Really?
Right? Well, yeah. I mean, people were kind of small
short
back
like
then.
Me. Okay.
Yeah, they didn't have any Wonder Bread or whatnot. That makes you Sure, I think.
Her growth hormones.
And the analysis concluded that such a historic figure would likely have had dark skin based on the Middle Eastern desert climate in which the New Testament stories took place. Experts have, the BBC declared, experts have decided Jesus would have been anything but pearly white. Now, this is kind of interesting because I always thought about it, you know, when for a while that when people, you know, back in the day, way back in the day, like in the 60s, when they're, the older generation insisted that you had to be, you know, uptight, all white, short hair, and all that, and you were really reviled if you had long hair or a beard.
So you were reviled.
And then I look at these paintings of Jesus, and I'm thinking, hippie.
Total hippie.
What is up with that? I mean, I still see people that look like that, right?
Well, you know one of those people. My next door neighbor. next door neighbor is a spitting image of the portrayals of Jesus that you see.
Is he blonde?
Well, he's got kind of light brown hair. Yeah.
Oftentimes they're blonde.
You've met him.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks he looks like Jesus.
Well, now that we're on religion, the generous mystery tipper who has been leaving waiters and waitresses across the country thousands of dollars in, quote, tips for Jesus.
Do you think they're really giving that to the church?
No, they're giving it to waiters. And,
yeah, I know. Yeah. So they're doing it in the name of Jesus?
Yeah. I mean, this guy's, it turns out, they identified him finally. Oh, yeah. He is Jack Selby, former PayPal vice president who sold off this stuff for millions of dollars. So he gives people thousands of dollars tips. And an Instagram account leaving the, how do you say that? It's, they got the @ tips for Jesus. Is that just it?
Yeah.
@tips for Jesus. Shows photos of the generous gratuities. Its tagline, doing the Lord's work, one tip at a time.
Now,
I got your tip.
I'll tell you what. You know, the Jesus that I have learned about and that people...
Didn't leave tips or did? He was a good tipper.
It was for humanity. I mean, this PayPal cat would do so much better to, say, go down to the soup kitchen and throw down a big old check right there. You know, do something for the homeless.
I mean, well, he's giving it to working class people.
Yeah, but you know what else he's doing?
What?
He wants attention for it.
Well, he was anonymous for a while.
Yeah, but of course he came out, oh, well, it was me.
You know where that goes back to?
It was just little old me.
The first Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller, who founded Standard Oil, and who, of course, ruined the environment in Pennsylvania where they were pumping oil and was terrible towards his workers and all that. He used to give dimes to people on the street.
Wow, how's generous.
Do people even remember dimes?
I have some in my purse.
They
right
still
now.
Have dimes?
Yes.
Wow.
But they are doing away with the penny eventually, aren't they?
Well, that's one of my major
platforms?
No, for reforms for this. Get rid of the penny.
Yeah.
Hear more religious news. A massive cross that serves as part of a war memorial on a San Diego hilltop must be dismantled because it has been found to violate a constitutional ban on government endorsement of religion. That's according to a federal judge, although he ruled grudgingly. He said, yeah, well, that's the deal. Because if you have this 43-foot-tall cross, that's like over a four-story building, it's a local landmark that has stood on top of Mount Soledad since 1954. It's visible for miles. And I was thinking, oh, are these folks going to get in trouble? A group of plaintiffs, including Jewish war veterans of the United States, sued. And so I was thinking, people are going, like that. But could you imagine of being of the Jewish faith, and there's supposed to be this war memorial for you, and it's this big cross?
Well, yeah, I would think it would be.
That's why the founding fathers, after the religious turmoil that they had seen in Europe, wanted to get religion out of the public sphere, or as they say, out of the public square. And when people force it into it, there's always a problem. I mean, if you had like a single, well, even when you have a single religion, if you think about it, like all Catholic nations or all Muslim nations, and you let them also have the reins of the government, things get nasty.
They do get nasty, and it does just on an interpersonal level, just like this story right there. And I'm just so tired of the whole thing because It just seems to me everyone who's very religious, these types of folks, you know, not the good Catholic boy who goes to church every Sunday and says his prayers and goes off and doesn't spout it off to everybody. But why so much? Why so much infighting between religions? It's really disconcerting.
It is. And here it goes. A small but growing movement by Jewish activists in Jerusalem are demanding the right to pray at the site of their destroyed temple in the heart of this disputed capital's old city. It's creating a potentially explosive clash with the Muslim world, which considers the spot holy and bans Jews from public worship there. Well, both sides.
Well, that, talk about one of the biggest messes on long term. Right
each
there.
Week, hundreds of Jews ascend the creaky wooden ramp built across the Western Wall and enter what is often called the most contested real estate on earth. Many of them embark upon a game of hide-and-seek with their police escorts, whispering forbidden prayers while pretending to talk into cell phones, and getting in quick but banned bows by dropping coins and then bending over to pick them up.
That is so weird.
It is very weird. Their proposal, long dismissed as extremist, are now being debated by the Israeli parliament and embraced by its expansionist wing in the ruling coalition. And it kind of goes on and on and on. This is, the Temple Mount these political leaders, many of them in the Netanyahu party, want Israel to assert more, not less, control over the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Old City, including the place known to Jews as the Temple Mount, and to the Muslims as Haram al-Sharif, or the Noble Sanctuary. Two millenniums ago, this place was the site of the Jews' Second Temple. It was destroyed by the Romans. The Western Wall is visited by 10 million people a year. It's part of the remaining part of it all, considered one of the holiest landmarks in Judaism. The same courtyard is home to Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of the oldest in Islam, and the Dome of the Rock, the golden landmark, where tradition says the Prophet Muhammad made his night journey to heaven. And it goes on and on and on. And these religions that are going to save people's souls and bring comfort to the sick and bless the stations of life are going to kill each other.
Yeah. It's just messy.
Enter George W. Bush, who wound up on the same plane with Barack Obama as they went over to South Africa for the funeral of Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
And did you see
that Hillary was there?
Yeah. Did you see the Jimmy Kimmel? They had that guy that was doing sign language for the deaf.
Yeah, the one who was just doing gibberish.
Well, they brought on
and this was at Mandela's service.
Yeah, and he was interpreting for everybody.
What I heard is he was saying the same thing over and over.
But Jimmy Kimmel brought in a deaf signing expert, and he said, "What's he saying?" He says, "Hello, cigarette, going, yes, I am, no, yeah, all right."
That was just the craziest story.
Yeah, yeah. But George W. Bush, according to a lot of people, including this essay on Alternate, which is alternate.org, did as much as he could to bring about Armageddon with his earlier interventions in the Middle East, but not the man himself, apparently. He has signed up for a fundraising event for Messianic Jewish Bible Institute, an organization which aims to promote the second coming of Christ by converting Jews to Christianity, spoke at their fundraiser in Irving, Texas.
Well, once again, he's on the wrong side of everything.
Yeah. Such Messianic Jews who accept that Jesus was the promised Messiah are loathed by most Jews and regarded with great suspicion by mainstream Christian denominations. But belief in the necessary conversion of the Jews still flourishes on the wilder shores of American Christianity. Portions of biblical prophecy seem to require it, and there is widespread confusion among evangelicals about whether Israel is really a kind of America overseas. A recent poll for the Pew Foundation found that twice as many American evangelicals as American Jews were unwavering in their support for Israel. This is something that successive Israeli governments have deliberately cultivated. In other words, that the Israeli government has cultivated the support of these right-wing evangelical Christians as being a bulwark of support for the United States, continuing to give these folks like $3 billion a year of our tax dollars.
That's right.
Exactly.
And people are bitching about Obamacare.
Yeah, Absolutely. Now, that, you know, now, the idea that either people, either you support Israel or don't you, is crazy. The way this is always
you want my answer?
Formulated. What?
I don't support what their government does.
Hello, that's it.
Okay, that's it.
It's not even a matter. I mean, it's like being critical. You know, it used to be like if you were critical of a Republican administration, one of their wars or their policy, you'd say, you're anti-American.
Right.
Yeah. So now, would you say that if you oppose any of Barack Obama's policies, you're anti-American or you don't support America? No. So
not.
You can be virulently critical, like so many Jewish Americans are, of Israeli policies without being anti-Israel or, quote, not supporting Israel.
Yeah. I explained this to a young, I think maybe she's 10, a 10-year-old young gal who is, her parents are from Iraq. They're Christians.
Yeah.
I think they're Catholic. But she said something about a Jewish kid at her school, and she said something about the kid being one of the good ones. Okay? And I thought, ooh, boy. And her dad looked at me, and he laughed, and I said, well, he goes, Julene, tell her, you know, how you feel about Israel. And I said, it's, you know, it's not the Israelis. It's their policies. It's
the political state, yeah.
The army.
Well, George Zimmerman in the news again. He's not going to face domestic violence charges because his girlfriend decided she didn't want to press charges.
Stupid, stupid, stupid.
Well, let's see. He had faced charges of aggravated assault, battery, and criminal mischief after a November 18th confrontation at the house he shared with his girlfriend, Samantha Scheib. So does he get all his guns back?
That's a good question.
And
probably.
What kind of guy visits his girlfriend and brings four guns with him?
A complete insane person?
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you know, there might be a reason.
Yeah.
He might have to waste
himself.
Another unarmed teenager.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
uh-huh.
You know, my theory on that one is, boy, full of theories, on George Zimmerman, he is going to do himself in, Peter. He will F up somehow.
Sure, well, he's been trying.
Yeah, he's doing a real good job of it. He had first of all, he killed Trayvon Martin. Sorry, that's my opinion. I'm not going back on it.
Everybody knows he killed him. An unwarranted killing.
Yes.
That he should have been found guilty, in our estimation, of second-degree murder.
Murder,
yeah.
That's what I should have said.
Yeah.
He then got into that domestic incident with his wife and her father. And
then he was speeding, remember, all this. He's an accident waiting to happen.
He is a wreck.
But there's a pattern going way back, years even before the Trayvon Martin killing.
Domestic
violence, confrontation with the police. And we've been asking, and no one has ever, I mean, I don't know why I'd do it again, because this would be strike three, but we've asked, do any of you have buyer's remorse? Those of you that so fervently defended George Zimmerman.
He was innocent. The kid beat him up.
Yeah, right. What could he do except shoot him? And it was actually Trayvon Martin who was on trial during the whole thing. This unarmed teenager who had every right to be where he was. And remember, we've been saying too, I wonder what these jurors think now too.
But
I doubt if we're going to get anybody that's going to
live with myself.
Yeah.
I would probably, you know, first of all, that verdict wouldn't have gone that way had I been on there, at least my part of it. But if I, let this guy go, I would definitely make it heard, make it the national media know, make the people know that I regretted that decision.
Sure. Well, Colorado, unfortunately, back in the news. In Centennial, Colorado, carrying a shotgun, a machete, a bandolier of ammunition, and a backpack with three firebombs, Carl Pearson entered Arapahoe High School and launched 80 seconds of terror as he hunted his debate coach shot this poor young woman in the face and then killed himself. I mean, I always wish these guys would do that first.
I mean, there's debate and there's debate.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not even making light of it.
Yeah.
But
you know,
using a gun to solve something.
Colorado is one of those states with they're really big into gun save lives. I wonder how many more mass shootings they're going to have before they get off that. You know, they passed them just barely, I don't know, you know, these tepid, mild background check laws, and they've kicked out these state senators that wanted something like, sort of a background check. I got to tell you that this Carl Pearson probably would have passed the background check. I mean, there's
probably right.
So it's the availability. Since 1970, 1.5 million Americans have died in gun-related incidents.
Did not know that number.
And it's in the last.
I mean, that's tough to even.
A million, yeah. I mean, that's a pile of bodies. And in America's wars, since our inception in 200 years or so, 1,200,000. So more people have died of gun violence since 1970.
War?
Yeah.
Than all the 200 years of war.
Yeah, so guns save lives. Well, I don't know. Maybe sometimes they do. They have at different times.
Sure.
But guns sure take a lot of lives, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Yeah. And by the way, so you had this terribly tragic incident, again in Colorado, a disturbed kid who acts out these fantasies of violence that has the availability of the weaponry with which to do it. And what does the right wing come up with?
Oh, something really bad, I'm sure.
He was a socialist, they said.
Oh, no!
That was what they...
How did I miss that?
All over, this friend of his, Joe Redman, an 18-year-old senior, said he was a self-proclaimed socialist, but he also wore a Communist Party T-shirt to confuse people. He said his political leanings were more anti-authoritarian than communist. So who knows even what that all means. But in the midst of these tragedies, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows where he was coming from? But to have that, the headline on some right-wing news sites that I looked at just shows you. I mean, finally they found somebody who wasn't who knows what he was, but that wasn't a right-wing gun nut that was shooting people. And most of these guys that wind up doing these mass murders are, heavily conservative. There was one. I don't think we talked about this. Was from during this Auburn and Alabama. Alabama lost to its arch rival Auburn.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that.
This was December 2nd, and a woman was charged with killing another woman at a party because she was angry that the victim and others did not seem upset enough that Alabama had lost.
My gosh.
And both women were Alabama fans at the party for the annual game. No time. Well, this was an incredible end to it. No time left on the clock. Auburn returned a missed Alabama field goal attempt and ran more than 100 yards because the guy was in the end zone.
Yeah.
The victim's sister, Nakessa Shepherd, said Brisley, this is the woman, flew into a rage when she saw the sisters and others joking that the Crimson Tide's loss was not as bad as if the Miami Heat had lost a game in the NBA. She said, we weren't real Alabama fans because it didn't bother us that they lost, and then she started shooting.
I just can't even believe someone would do that. These sports people, they get a little crazy. I mean, earlier today there were a few people just hanging around, and someone brought up, you know, the Rose Bowl and who's not going and blah, blah, blah. And people just turn. They turn. Yeah. They get mad. Not you, Jefferson. Jefferson was there. But who, by the way, is taking your phone calls? He just listened.
Yeah. Yeah, if you'd like to join us. I forgot about you guys. 248-544-WRIF. Yeah, we're just raving here. One more sort of gun thing. This was an unarmed man, but he was unarmed and emotionally disturbed, and police shot at him as he was lurching around traffic near Times Square in September, and he has been charged with assault on the theory that he was responsible for bullet wounds suffered by two bystanders. The cops shot them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's a world gun man!
Yeah, right.
And it's just getting madder every day.
So this guy was just throwing himself into the path of oncoming cars. A curious crowd grew. Police officers arrived and tried to corral the guy. And when he reached into his pants pocket, two officers who the police said thought he was pulling a gun opened fire, missing him but hitting two nearby women. Finally, they knocked him down with a taser. Well, hard to second guess what's going on there. All right.
Yeah.
Times
Square is kind of busy, and I do know that, there's a high police presence there. They're nervous about anything happening, especially since September 11th.
Well, then one of the things that's happened is, and that's odd that only two shots were fired, because increasingly in police incidents where shots are fired, there are multiple shots, sometimes as many as 50 and 60.
Like New York.
Yeah. Yeah, New York's really big on
that. Especially New York, yeah.
All right, you know, we should get to the really serious, not that this stuff isn't serious, but there's a lot going on with marijuana, with smoking cigarettes, with opium cultivation, and with e-cigarettes.
Well, we do try to cover the bases.
Yeah, yeah, but I want to get back into some of this stuff about not extending unemployment, this new budget that was agreed to by the representative of the Democratic Senate and the Republican House, which, of course, just makes the world safe for the military-industrial complex. All right. Any e-smokers, e-cigarette smokers there, we want to talk to you. Give us a call.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The weekend brought to you by McDonald's. The new McDonald's Mighty Wings have officially landed for a limited time only at participating McDonald's. I'm loving the riff. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and give us a call. We've been talking about what? Religion. We've been talking about what else?
Well, mostly religion.
Yeah. We talked about some other stuff. Oh, yeah, the shooting in Colorado.
Jeez.
Yeah. 248-544-WRIF, which is...
248-544-9743. We have open lines, and we want to hear from you.
I was just looking at our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. I mean, it's total narcissism because it's just filled with pictures of me and pictures.
This is nothing compared to those Facebook pictures. We have very few pictures of us, usually.
You know,
it's about other things.
I was reading that.
We're like the least narcissistic talk show out there. Yes.
Well, you know, maybe I'm suffering from what they say some of these young women do. They have presentation anxiety. In other words, how they appear on Facebook, what photos they post.
Well, I think everyone does.
Well, one, how they look, and secondly, are they posting other photos that are hip or, you know, or not hip, you know?
Like selfies in the bathroom or what?
I don't know, whatever. Got a nice photo of me and Jalene at our Greater Media WRIF Christmas party. One of my faves here. It's really incredible. Skiing in Detroit, these trick skiers. Did you finally look at it?
I actually saw it before you saw it, as a matter of fact.
No, you didn't.
I believe I did.
No, you didn't. Okay, go ahead.
Well, basically, these professional trick skiers came in and shot video at the Packard plant.
At the old closed Packard plant, inside of it.
Around, inside, up, all around it, on the sides of the building.
On the roof?
It was insane.
Jumping off of
all the different structures
and
such
slamming into
space.
Chimneys with their skis and then dropping down and jumping off the second floor.
Isn't that amazing? You have to check this video out. Yeah. Go to our Facebook page and check it out.
So it's facebook.com/nightcall.
Not to be narcissistic, but if you double click on the picture of us, you can see the giant vodka cranberry that I was enjoying.
Oh, is that one? Okay.
And you did count my drinks, even though you were driving.
I was. But there's stuff about the Heidelberg Project, which is this...
You know, we have not spent enough time talking about this, Peter.
You're going to have to... Let me see if I can grab it. The Heidelberg Project, if you aren't aware, is this art installation that covers several blocks in one of Detroit's poorest areas.
And it's a huge draw. People come from all over the world to check it out. Peter and I have been there numerous times.
Sure.
We've helped beautify it.
Yep.
We buried a Hummer. We helped bury a pink Hummer.
That's right. Oh, you were there for that.
Planted flowers.
Because on our Facebook page, on the Night Call Facebook page, there is a rad put up there, talk about narcissism. There's a photograph of me and Medea Benjamin.
Of Code Pink. And you may or may not have heard of her, but she's this teeny little rabble-rouser.
She is a rabble-rouser.
She's all over the world making a difference. She just went to, where was she? It was over in the Middle East.
I'm sure.
Presenting something on drones.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hey, speaking of drones, I was thinking, you know, this whole idea to talk about all over the board. You know, Amazon is talking about delivering its products by drone.
No.
You never heard this?
No.
This was big. So 30 minutes after you order something from Amazon, if you're in the right area, like in the Detroit area, you'd have it at your door by drone.
I don't want any drone coming anywhere near me for now, any purpose.
I was thinking, though.
Pretty soon they'll have drone drug dealers.
Why not? Yeah, well, sure. But think about this. So you have, so people would figure if something is being delivered by drone, it's got to be valuable. So what might they do?
I don't know.
They might shoot it down.
The
bad guys.
Oh, the bad guys.
Yeah. So here comes a drone, like, say, with, I don't know what. With
books.
So, well.
CDs.
Something a little, some electronic.
A laptop.
Yeah, a laptop. All right, a laptop.
Xbox One.
So they shoot it down. So there's only one thing to do with the Amazon drones. Weaponize them.
Oh, God.
So they can shoot back.
Oh, now you're getting a little conspiracy-ish on me. That's so unlike you.
Well, think about stagecoaches. They used to have a guy riding shotgun, right? That's how that phrase came into being.
Really?
Right?
I learn something every week.
You didn't know that? When people would say they want to sit in the... You got three people coming in.
I mean, I know about that.
And you're saying shotgun.
I didn't know the origin.
That's the origin,
of,
sure.
That saying.
That means you get to sit up front next to the driver.
Right on. I didn't know that.
Really?
Okay.
Shotgun, I called it.
Yeah, I've done that before. Now, where did you hear about this Amazon drone thing?
It was
Amazon?
All over. Yeah, I mean, the guy made a big splash, the CEO of it, yeah.
Did he really?
Yeah, yeah. But the whole thing about weaponized drones, I mean, and in some ways, it's a terrible thing to joke about.
It is terrible because so many innocent civilians all over the world, basically, have died due to these.
And 11 members of a wedding party in Yemen were just killed, civilians. And
by a little drone.
Yeah. And, of course,
powerful.
Somebody was sitting, like, in Colorado Springs and, okay, oops, sorry about that. Let's go get a beer, right?
It's just awful.
Yeah. But Detroit's Heidelberg Project, Tyree Guyton, an amazing guy and a great artist in his own, took what had often been done by a lot of Southern African Americans, and particularly ones who had migrated to Detroit in the 1940s, and were using things like hubcaps and other discarded things.
Teddy bears.
Teddy bears. No, this is the Heidelberg Project. I'm talking about that previous to this, and in Detroit,
okay, so like
I've seen, yeah, I've seen other things to like make this spectacular display of, in a way, is like junk, but pretty interesting. So Tyree Guyton expanded this concept to involve all of these, I mean, street after street after street. He had it out, and I think in the 1980s with Mayor Coleman Young, who actually bulldozed a lot of, because I don't know if we're being clear, if you don't know what this is. For instance, I should have posted a lot of photographs because I've taken a lot of
photographs. It's a lot of abandoned homes.
Some of them are abandoned homes. Some of them were people that lived in and enjoyed it, but would take the junk, of America, of the streets, and make art objects of it. Hoods of cars. In fact, there's one of those down on the Riverwalk, one of the hoods of a car, that with art on it. But he had a real eye for things. He'd have like a television, and there would be like a Christian cross on the screen.
Yeah.
And he would, you know, is this, and or television would say God, or have like 20 old stand-up vacuum cleaners, each with a boot on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so what's occurred?
Oh, yeah.
Is since last summer, I can't remember.
May.
Since May. 8 of these houses have been set on fire.
Yeah.
There is an arsonist on the loose trying to destroy this, what I feel is a treasure in this city, a treasure of junk and art in this city. The clock house, when I got home from this show last week, I stay up. I was on Facebook, and I saw my friend had posted that the clock house was on fire, and that is a house with clocks, basically. And so it was the 8th structure. How many are left?
I don't know, because some of them, like, are inhabited. I hope those didn't get it. The founder and artistic director, Tyree Guyton, has called in, and they've agreed. The U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives have been investigating this along with the Detroit Arson Squad. They've offered a $25,000 reward for leading to the arrest and conviction of who's responsible for it.
Boy, whoever does this is the master of getting in and getting out.
Yeah, and I don't even know if we've portrayed it well, but I guess to see some photographs, you just go to Heidelberg Project.
Yeah, just Google it.
Yeah, it's Heidelberg, Heidelberg Project.
There's a fundraiser going on right now. I believe the last I read was they are $5,000 away from their goal, because what they're trying to do is beef up security, and so they need the funds to do that.
Yeah, and sometimes they look whimsical. Because Tyree Guyton, being an African-American, very aware of the experience of people of African ancestry in America. So there is this little motorboat. Well, it's probably, what would it be?
Looks like a little rowboat.
It's about 12 feet long, and it's stuffed with maybe, 200 old
teddy bears. At least.
You know what that's called, though?
No.
You ready?
You've told me.
Slave ship.
Yeah, that's right. I did know that.
So it goes from the whimsical to the ominous.
Yeah.
I think
that describes the whole thing. You could look into each one of those installments and find something pretty deep.
Yeah. And people, though, have come from Europe to live on Heidelberg Street.
I did not know that.
In order to be close to this internationally recognized project. There is one place where all these, there's these shoes, maybe 50, 100 pairs of shoes up in this tree. And again, it just looks kind of something like out of surrealism or, whimsical.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if that's the name, but it's like lynching.
Yes.
Yeah. So that again, which is
strange fruit.
Strange Fruit, that's
Billie
what it's
Holiday
called.
Song.
Yeah.
There's the fact that the DIA, I don't know if it's still up, but have you seen the Strange Fruit display down there?
No.
It's just like a box, like this kind of small wooden box.
Can't use your hands on radio.
Small wooden box.
That's what I do.
I cannot talk without using my hands, so just picture
it. I'm not
going to
look.
And they have that song playing in there. It's so eerie. It's just this very simple display. But if it's still there, well, everyone should go to the DIA anyway.
All right.
And the Heidelberg Project.
Let's go back to the desire, almost the universal desire of humans and many animal species to change their consciousness. I mean, when they do, when scientists do all sorts of experiments, allowing like test animals, which they shouldn't be doing, to imbibe or to get some sort of euphoria, they go for it. Elephants love to drink fermented fruit and kind of go on a wild. Then actually, they do in India.
That fermented fruit really can get it.
Yeah.
My next door neighbor dog.
Yeah.
Is an alcoholic.
Really?
Bruce, the King Charles Cavalier Spaniel, he's a drunk. And I've got this mulberry bush, and he waits for those to drop. And he comes over, and one day I came outside, because we kind of go back and forth between our backyards. It's a small.
Sure.
I live in a small hippie commune, and I'm proud of it.
Neighborhood.
It's just two houses, and we're a commune. Anyway, so I came over one day, and he was passed out. And I got him up, and he's stumbling around. So elephants, listen, Bruce just wants to change his consciousness.
There you go. Well, Uruguay has approved legislation this week that will allow the country to legalize the cultivation and sale of marijuana on a nationwide scale. This is the first country in the entire world. Think of all the changes that we're going through. People think of, big changes like of the 1960s, the 1920s, and what have you. And now, this lot's happening. Think about gay marriage. Think about finally this war on the people of the United States, which was called
the war on
drugs. Gee, there was this article was quoting from the congressional testimony of Harry Anslinger, who was the first head of the Narcotics Bureau, the Federal Narcotics Bureau.
The DEA?
Well, what became the DEA, DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and he was actually like J. Edgar Hoover on steroids. And
really?
If you can imagine that. And he was the most insane.
Without the cross-dressing.
Yeah. Oh, well, who knows? But he was this insane racist. And he testified that that marijuana was, this was 1938, there was something called the, finally, the federal law, the Marijuana Stamp Tax Act, or the Marijuana Tax Act, mm-hmm. for which you still have to buy, supposedly, if you have marijuana, you're supposed to buy a federal stamp.
I know people who have their cards, and they don't have anything. Yeah, I don't even know where you go to get something like that.
No. But so Harry Anslinger, testifying before Congress, said that it is the most dangerous drug in the world, marijuana, that it particularly had this effect on...
On
Negroes, as he said, which was probably the nicest thing he ever said about him. Filipinos, I don't know where he got on that, and Mexicans who lusted after white women once they've smoked it.
I don't know why that makes me laugh. It's just so ridiculous.
Yeah, so all the good old boys.
I mean, if you like a white woman, you like a white woman. If, I don't care if you're high or not.
Yeah, so good old, all the good old Southern boys in Congress said, yeah, we got to pass this, and that's sort of the origin of it. But anyway, so Uruguay, they have, as it says here, Uruguay's leftist president, Jose Mujica, a supporter of the measure, said he's going to sign it. They voted Uruguay would create a state-run institute for the regulation and control of cannabis to oversee the planting, harvesting, and sale.
And sold at pharmacies.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it says buyers signing up in a state registry process enabling them to purchase up to 40 grams a month at $1 a gram. From what I understand, that's
dollar
a gram.
Yeah. Opponents contended the measure would open the way for general drug use in Uruguay, while supporters claimed it would remove the marijuana trade from the domain of illegal traffickers, you think?
Right, because it also says, you know, it's a country that's been, as many, many countries are, because of a lot of these laws, that they've been grappling with an increase in drug-related violence. Can you say Mexico?
Yeah. Don't you think, though, that it probably, if it was illegal, I'm sorry, if it was legal, that probably it would have an expanded usage. So?
I don't know how much. It would be interesting.
I mean, we all love our legal highs, our cigarettes
alcohol.
And our beer and our liquor. And
we threw down at our Christmas party.
You threw down.
Nice.
I was your DD.
Listen, but I'm
your
smart.
Designated driver. You are my DD, my designated drunk.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm smart because I when this is my when you have your holiday parties, people, a little advice from Julene is when you start feeling a little tipsy,
yeah,
get your in the car with your designated driver and get the hell out of there. I was gone by 8:30. I found out people were doing shots at 1 in the morning.
Is that right?
Oh yeah. I would have disrobed by then.
Well, wait till next year.
Running around naked, singing songs on the karaoke machine. Had to go.
So I dropped you off.
Yes.
And then I went to the bar.
I know. Good times.
Yeah. It says, while marijuana is already tolerated to a large degree in Uruguay, the law would allow households growing up to 6 plants each and cooperatives to form to grow up to 99 plants. But some opposition to the law has been voiced in neighboring countries, while the International Narcotics Control Board of the United Nations said we could turn, an opposition senator in Uruguay, said we could turn into a regional center of cannabis tourism. So
Amsterdam is what they're talking about.
Yeah, and you know what's happened to Amsterdam.
I've been there. It's the most peaceful city ever.
So what would be wrong with, it still has this stigma of, I don't know. I mean, I'm lacking the words to describe it. In other words, we are all concerned.
Burnout. Like the burnout stigma?
Well, it has just a lot of negative stigmas to it. I mean, we know the problems, the mass problems with alcohol consumption. I mean, what it causes in violence. That's the most violent drug in the world,
yes.
Without a doubt.
Without a doubt.
Without a doubt. More people are killed as a result of alcohol usage. You add to that driving, of course.
Yes.
Interpersonal violence.
It brings out rage.
Rage in people, the child and domestic abuse and all that. Yeah. And yet it's still,
It's the way.
What's the way?
Alcohol.
Oh.
That's what Americans do, especially. I mean, they drink all over the world, but
All right. Before, though, we were talking last week about how the Republicans have put this bill in Congress that would allow smoking in restaurants outside, you know, like on patios and what have you.
And this is Michigan?
Michigan. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. Michigan, not Uruguay.
I didn't know if you meant federal.
But before we have to go to our break, which is coming just on it, I wanted to raise something that, and I have no idea of what's going on about it. And that's vaping, which is, instead of smoking, having those e-cigarettes where you inhale this vapor that gives you a shot of nicotine.
Right.
And can you still blow smoke rings? That's what I used to love about smoking.
Yeah, you can.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, you can still. They're not as intense.
Oh, because, you know, I still do. When it's, you know, like six above zero.
Because I know you're not putting a cigarette in your mouth.
No. But so there was this big deal in New York that where they were going to ban them. And
them outside or
inside. Yeah. It said people in the crowd of about 200. Let me see. I should start at the beginning. A woman in a skin-tight dress lounged in the front row of the city council chamber in New York, sucking on an electronic cigarette and blowing out sweetly scented clouds as if she were at a nightclub. Other people in the crowd of about 200 did the same, puffing on devices like a red-tipped cigarette clone, a green glass hookah, and something that looked like a black pencil with a glowing blue tip. Unlike smoke from regular cigarettes, which would have formed a fetid smog over the room, the plumes were from these cigarettes left only the most fleeting impression before evaporating. So anyone in this hearing used the word smoke or smoking to refer to the electronic cigarettes, which typically contain nicotine, was instantly corrected by the audience hissing, "Vapor and vaping!"
Really?
Yeah. So are there any of you e-cigarette smokers out there?
Yeah. I'd be curious. I mean, I know people who do that and who have that. And, in fact, our former morning show on that used to be here at the station, they used those.
Well, that's good for them because they were puffing down the real ones for a long time.
I know.
The health commissioner in New York said that electronic cigarettes were such a recent invention that he couldn't say whether they were hazardous to the health of those smoking them or those who might breathe in secondhand vapor. So.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it really is kind of just vapor. It's kind of like it's air. And it has, from when I've been around people who've been puffing on one of those, just kind of has the very most faint herbal smell. I thought it was slightly pleasant.
Yeah, actually. Well, they sent them. So, and what essentially people are doing in order to get a little nicotine high, because nicotine is a mood enhancer.
It gives you a little buzz.
Yeah.
Gives you a little buzz.
It gives you a buzz if you don't, you don't get a buzz if you do it all the time.
Right.
I mean, the first time I smoked a cigarette when I was a kid, I got so dizzy I almost fell over.
Me too, yeah.
But then.
A cool filter king.
Oh, there you go.
Fifth grade.
Hey, all right, so any of you vapers out there, give us a shout. And we will. I want to still get back to this $15 an hourly minimum wage in Seattle, which, guess who's trying to overturn it?
I wonder.
We'll be right back.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number, 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night call.
I'm a good gift giver. No, a fantastic gift giver. What do I get in return? An unnecessary cheek pinch. I deserve more. So this year, I'm giving Buffalo Wild Wings gift cards. Because for every $25 I spend, I get a $5 bonus coupon to give to myself. So the next time I hear, "Oh, that's so sweet," it better be referring to honey barbecue sauce.
Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings. Beer. Sports. Valid in restaurant at participating locations only. For a limited time while supplies last. Certain terms and conditions may apply.
Ever hear somebody say, "We can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way"? I mean, what kind of a choice is that? At GEICO.com, everything's easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to go paperless by automatically paying your bid online. Easy, easy, easy. So visit GEICO.com today. Of course, if you prefer the hard way, I guess you'll have to go someplace else. Sorry, I just don't get it.
Betsy, look at these sweaters. They look amazing on our girls.
Maybe.
come on. What's wrong?
Suzanne, I have no business being in the store. I should not be shopping. Things are really tight. We're behind on our mortgage.
Listen, Bill and I had the same problem, and we got some really great counseling, and it was free. I'm going to email you the information.
If you even think you may be in danger of foreclosure, call the National Foundation for Credit Counseling today at 866-687-6322 or visit MortgageHelpNow.org. Public service from the NFCC.
So December 27th, and maybe an upgrade to the front row. Details online at WRIF.com.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening. listening to Night Call, the Ritz award-winning talk show on 101 WRIX.
All right, we are ready, and hope you are as well. 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743. We have open lines, and we're talking about a variety of things, from the legalization of marijuana in Uruguay and what that means for the rest of the world.
First nation to do that.
South America. Talking about electronic cigarettes and how in New York there's a little battle going on.
Yeah, they want to ban them. And one of the things they say that it encourages people to smoke real cigarettes. And I would think that it would get a lot of people off of them.
Because
most people that are, I mean, that tobacco, all of this, nicotine is so addicting that they have this addiction rate. Like people that use heroin, people can look this up. I'm not sure what the statistics are.
They say that quitting smoking is
the hardest.
Is tougher to stop than heroin.
That, for one thing, if like the first time heroin user has, like I say, for instance, 40% chance of being a heroin addict.
Yeah.
A crack user has, I don't know, say 50 or 60% or 20%. I don't know, whatever it is. Cigarette, 100%. You use it, you're addicted.
Right.
Yeah, right. And people just go on. I mean, one of the things is that it's socially fashionable. And, you know, there are so many movies and TV things now set in the 50s. So everybody's smoking all the time.
Puff, puff, pass.
Puff, puff, puff.
Oh, wait,
right.
That's a different one. So we do have someone on the line who
all right,
wants
to talk about
electronic
yeah.
cigarettes. And I'm also curious, not just for those hearing from those who smoke them, but for people who have been around them and if they are bothered by it.
Yeah, I haven't been. On the face of it, I think I'd be a little taken aback, but I don't think I would object to it.
I don't think you would either.
Yeah.
And I know you pretty
because,
darn well.
You know, we always say about tobacco cigarettes, suicide yes, murder no. So
yes.
You can kill yourself, just don't do it to other people. But actually, I don't want you to kill yourself either. And maybe this solves it because you get the nicotine buzz that you want and out without all the problems. Here's Jared in Waterford. Jared, thanks for calling 248-544-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, Julian, I love the show.
First-time
caller, long-time listener.
Well, thank you.
Welcome.
Well, so about the electronic cigarettes, I'm only 20 years old. I've been, unfortunately, smoking cigarettes for about 5 years now. And I have tried electronic cigarettes. They're of course, better for you.
But they're not the same, right?
Yes, exactly. They're nowhere near the same.
What don't you get out of it, Jared?
Well, you don't get it, like you said, Peter. You get high off of it. You do get a nicotine buzz. I get kind of numb all over from actual tobacco cigarettes. With the nicotine or with the electronic cigarettes, it varies. They have different nicotine levels. Some of them make you just as numb as a regular cigarette, but. Those are usually the menthol ones.
You get numb from, I mean, I used to smoke. And let me tell you, here's what you need to quit smoking. It wasn't fear of disease or death. It was my girlfriend at the time who refused to kiss me.
I had one of those, too. She didn't stick around very long.
Oh, that's funny.
Well, we grew up and I married her.
Yes, you did.
Yeah.
The thing that I wanted to touch on was... With regard to electronic cigarettes, they've actually they've been around so long that the dispensaries here in Michigan have started offering. They're kind of a variation of electronic cigarettes. They're called e-pens, and it's the same thing. It's the same circuitry and makeup as an electronic cigarette, but you don't put the nicotine, whatever it is that you use to refill it. You can actually put marijuana in it. There's
right.
This oil that you can put in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have seen that about. So I don't know. I don't know what the downside is. Actually, I'll tell you, Jared.
It's so kind of new that I don't think anyone really knows, don't you think?
Yeah.
Well, they're very expensive and they break really easily, so they're kind of novelties right now.
Wow. Cigarettes. How much are cigarettes a pack now?
Like $8, $7
They're $7 a pack.
And you know,
and
who,
yeah, I've done the math. My father's, he berates me every day. He tells me to do the math, and I spend around $3,000 a year.
Oh my God. You know, well, they, you know, they've, it's, legal addiction. You know, the police go all out to stop you from being addicted to heroin or, crack or something like that, or even from smoking marijuana. And yet, man, that's
I'm allowed to kill myself with cigarettes, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it, you know, I don't, never mind. I won't lecture you. All right, Jared. Thank you very much.
Peter.
Thank you, guys. You guys have a nice holiday.
Yeah, so, well, thank you very much. Appreciate
Thanks,
that
Jared.
As well. And remember, keep the X in Xmas. Because it's
we
no longer.
Celebrate. We celebrate solstice. I think that's the only holiday.
Yeah, this isn't an insulting thing to religious people. We don't mean it like that, but rather it is, it's a totally a commercial holiday at worst, and at best it's a family holiday. I think there are, you know, there's a small minority of people that actually celebrate it as a religious holiday.
Yes.
But that's not very many.
Yeah, I mean, there's some faiths where presents aren't allowed, right?
Wow, I'm not going to join that one. But, you know, there's so many people that are dropping smoking because there certainly is a tremendous awareness of how dangerous cigarettes are to your health.
Yeah, I was out at a radio gig, and I met these Canadians, and she had a pack of Canadian cigarettes.
I meant to
bring it and show it to you, but I because she gave me her empty pack, and I forgot to show it to you, and I threw it away. But it was, you know, pretty. There were pictures of black lungs and the warning.
Faces.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah. I don't think it does much to dissuade
people.
No,
she was just puffing away, you know? And I, of course, I looked at it and I was just like, ah!
Well, as of all the manner in which we dose ourselves, probably tobacco is the absolute worst. Worst. And one of the things, well, a couple of things. First,
and alcohol.
It has a, well, yeah, I mean, I wonder what kills more people, alcohol or cigarettes?
I don't know. Any doctors out there with some info?
How about this? According to the World Health Organization, more than 5 million people die annually of smoking-related causes, and it's more from AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined.
Well, I mean, well, the AIDS part is astounding, but tuberculosis?
Oh, yeah, it's on the rise.
Is it
big
really?
Time. Yeah, malaria doesn't seem to go away as well. But the smoking thing is, of course, this legitimate industry.
Well, in the eyes of the tobacco people, it's legitimate.
And it has a class factor to it. The higher you go in the class pyramid in our country, the less people smoke. To the point where among the wealthy, it's unusual to find people that are actually still smoking. There are some, I mean, without a doubt.
Yes,
but
of course.
But it's odd that given the extraordinary cost of cigarettes, I mean, 50 years ago or so, I think cigarettes were like 25 cents a pack, and now they're $7 and something, you're saying? So, how much is it? How many in a carton? 10 or 12? I forgot.
I think it's 20.
20 cartons or 20 packs in a...
Oh, a carton? Do people still buy cartons?
Well, I don't think they can afford it anymore.
No, that has to be a lot.
Yeah, and there's no more...
I think there's 10 packs in a carton.
Yeah, right. And so 70, so they could, it could be like $70?
Yeah, and I know many people who have taken to buying the big bags of like pipe tobacco.
Yeah.
And they roll their own. It's a lot cheaper that way.
Oh, but how many people do that?
I know several.
Yeah.
Actually, in my little circle.
But here's what's going on. Tobacco companies are pushing back against the worldwide rise in anti-smoking laws. So these tobacco companies are fighting against anti-smoking laws.
They're very powerful, the tobacco industry.
And one of the things about it is here in the United States, children are being poisoned by tobacco cultivation. When the nicotine that exudes from wet tobacco leaves, when they hire migrant kids to go through there, and some Americans as well, and that is absorbed into their body, they get violently ill.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I mean, it's this horror story. And they think it may do some longstanding neurological diseases, but they try to wear gloves and cover themselves up. Sometimes they're, this is all like in North Carolina, places like that, no unions, no protections. And I was reading this article in The Nation magazine, and it was talking about how they, the adults were saying, if you start to feel nauseated, leave the field immediately.
Jeez.
And it was really, really terrible.
Let alone when you'll pull up next to a car and there's moms smoking up, puffing away with the windows up and the kids in the seat. I still see that.
Well, remember when we used to have CD players in here, that you couldn't smoke in the, well, I mean, now you can't smoke anywhere in the building.
Yeah.
But that it would actually, the nicotine, what would it be? The tar that you're exhaling would actually fog the lens that read the CD.
Yeah. My first radio job, we puffed right away in there.
Sure.
We did.
Yeah. All right. Well, here, Regina's on the line from Eastport. We always love talking to her. Regina, how you doing? We'll get back to this thing about the tobacco ferns, but go ahead. Hi, you're on the air.
That's what I was going to discuss. I'm trying to quit right now.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I've got two cigarettes left, and hopefully I'll be asleep soon, because I'm like, oh boy, my daughter who's a nurse, she said, it's harder to quit smoking, Mom, than it is to quit heroin.
Just what we were talking about. Yeah.
And you know what I think about right now? When I bore my two children, I didn't hardly smoke at all because I was so worried about my unborn child. And now I'm thinking, you know what? You better worry about yourself, girl.
Sure.
So I just got out of the emergency room with bronchitis.
Oh, no.
How are you doing?
Well, you know what you could do? You could have one this 15 minutes and then have one the last half hour of our show, then go to bed and wake up with a new attitude tomorrow, Regina.
There you go.
Okay. You know what? I'm not even going to have, I'm going to light it up and put it out like I did when I was pregnant.
Oh.
Like, but you know, Regina, one of the things.
Sometimes just having something in your hand.
Yeah.
Like
If you can do go ahead. Go ahead. You got what?
Go ahead, honey.
Okay, I was going to say, if you can just quit through willpower, like that's what my dad did. He just, boom, stopped smoking.
There you go.
Stop drinking, boom. Stop smoking, boom. You know, like that.
The money involved, too, plus your health, it just doesn't make sense. But it's very hard. You just sit, and especially when you watch those 50s movies. I agree with you guys. I'm watching those movies, and they're all puffing away, and they're right in front of you, and you're going along with them.
Smoke.
But here's what I was saying. I mean, a lot of people can do it by willpower. Well, some people can do it by willpower. But the American Lung Association has all these tips. Like, for one thing, don't go where people smoke a lot.
Yes. Well, now that's
it's kind of that is changed.
Thing.
But, there's certain foods. Like, you don't do fried foods. I can't remember what it all is. But it's stuff like that.
Little, have a sucking candy. That's
there you go.
My sister
nicotine.
And her husband. I was with all day, and they were lighting up and lighting up and lighting up, and I'm sitting in the back seat going, I am not lighting up. This is ridiculous.
You didn't have to. If you were in a closed car, you didn't have to.
I'm going, okay. But the urge was there, but I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. I just got over bronchitis.
So what about electronic cigarettes?
We tried one Thanksgiving. My sister and I, we tried it, and she was mad because we barely even hit the thing, and it was out. It was $5. She goes, heck, I could have bought a pack of cigarettes almost for this. And I said, well.
Almost, yeah.
Yeah.
That's how one of them.
For one?
Oh, then you can refill it, though, right?
Well, we shared one.
Yeah.
She and I, because it was freezing cold outside, too. And we.
You can smoke those inside, though. Well, Regina, thank you for your story.
Good luck.
Yeah, I want to get, do it. And, sometimes people try it and then it doesn't work and then they give up, but don't give up. All right, Regina, thanks for calling us at 248-544-WRIF. Well, here's what's happening with the tobacco companies. A lot of countries are starting to pass anti-smoking laws, but the tobacco companies, which are these multi-billion dollar firms, they're warning countries that their tobacco laws violate an expanding web of trade and investment treaties, raising the prospect for the governments of costly prolonged legal battles And that's under things like NAFTA and what's the W, the World Trade Organization kind of things, this new TPP. I'm even forgetting what the Treaty of the Pacific, something or other. But it would, you know, that it, this would be restraint of trade because cigarettes are this legal commodity.
Yes.
You can't pass laws limiting it. Although, doesn't the United States?
Yeah.
So the strategy has gained momentum in recent years as smoking rates in rich countries have fallen and tobacco companies have sought to maintain access to fast-growing markets in developing countries. In other words, they're looking for more victims.
Yes, they are.
I mean, they know. Can you imagine this working in an industry where you are an official? I mean, it's one thing to be in the fields or what have you, or maybe even at lower levels of it all, and you know you're going to kill 5 million people a year.
Yeah.
We talk about things like, you know, the Holocaust, where 6 million people died. And imagine what that means. 5 million people a year die because of the industry of which you are a part of. That's pretty...
As we always talk about people who, you know, do things that are evil and can sleep at night.
Yeah. Well, for instance, Namibia, which is in southern Africa, passed a tobacco control law in 2010, but suddenly they were receiving all these, pardon me, stern warnings that from the tobacco industry that the new statute violated the country's obligations under trade treaties. 3 years later, fearful of a punishing, expensive legal battle, they've yet to carry out a single major provision of the law, like limiting advertising or placing large health warnings on cigarette packages. They can't even do that. Let's try some more people want to talk about smoking. Here is Laura. Laura is in Farmington. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the... smokeless cigarettes or e-cigarettes are not FDA regulated, so we have no idea what they're putting in them.
See,
and they're
not necessarily better.
Yeah.
We don't really know. Correct.
We don't. Right. So, and the other thing is, they think that kids are using these and getting hooked on nicotine.
Sure.
And then they switch over to tobacco because it's cheaper.
It's the gateway cigarette.
Yeah. Rather than getting people off. I mean, I could imagine on one end adults getting off using them, and on the other hand, this revolving door of more young people.
They can get away with smoking those easier.
Yeah.
You know?
And,
yeah.
You know, what do you think, Laura? I think there's an increasing, things have changed. Before, the worst thing in the world was smoking a cigarette for, say, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. But coming back at us, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of hip. It's kind of chic. It's kind of 50s. You know, do you see that at all?
I am seeing that, I guess. I'm a smoker since I was a teenager. I'm planning on quitting, but you know how it goes. We know how addictive it is.
Yeah.
But I think that with the e-cigarettes, it's making it more exciting to kids, and that's who they're trying to get hooked, because once you're hooked, you're hooked.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and there's a finality about it. I mean, I've talked to people that have tried all their lives to quit and just can't do it. Yeah. I mean, one thing, the nicotine, we find out, is also a relaxant. It's a stimulant. It's a stimulant in a way.
And
you know what? I'm going to start. I'm getting into an area of lack of expertise. I don't think I'm going to try to define what.
Like sometimes when you're stressed and you have a smoke, it calms your nerves, right?
Exactly.
There.
But it's also a stimulant, so. It does both.
You know,
well,
Laura,
it's also like alcohol is a depressant, yet, boy, when I drink, I laugh my ass off.
Until the next day.
Oh, no, I don't get hangovers ever. I honestly don't.
But a couple shows ago, we were talking about how in mental institutions that that cigarettes are used as a reward and as a punishment. In other words, if you do what you're supposed to, you get a cigarette, and they're very vital to the psyche of people that have great mental disturbance. I'm not saying you do,
Well, that's nice of you, Peter.
Because,
well, I think, I don't know now because all the hospitals are non-smoking, so I don't know if they're allowed to do that anymore.
No.
Nursing homes. I used to work in a nursing home when I was in high school, and that's what they would do to the ornery little patients. They'd say, you're not going to get your two cigarettes.
Yeah, they didn't know. The hospital, nowhere on the campus, as they call them, can anyone smoke.
Right.
But in mental institutions, they're an integral part of it. And actually that mental patients, people that are in institutions for life, have this really low life expectancy. I mean, they think a lot of it has to do with cigarette smoking. All right, Laura, go ahead. Were you going to say something?
No, I said it could.
Okay, then thank you so much for calling.
Thanks for calling.
All right, thanks.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. You have happy holidays. Oh, and we just lost our the next caller, but what the hey. Anyway,
call back.
Yeah.
Have a little patience. Some people have to get up and go to work.
The issue is about these tobacco companies fighting against any anti-smoking laws is particularly urgent now as the United States completes talks on a major new trade treaty with 11 Pacific Rim countries, the TPP, that aims to be a model for the rules of international commerce. An administration official said they want the new treaty to raise standards for health. They single out tobacco as a health concern, wording that upset the good old U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who said that inclusion would leave the door open for other products like soda or sugar to be heavily regulated in other countries. So what these free trade, very, very awful.
It's a very misleading.
Yeah, yeah.
Term.
And so what it does, it does not allow for regulation. And if you say all commodities, all legal commodities, and I mean, there's some logic here that if all legal commodities have the same status, how can you single out one? I mean, if you have no tariffs or restrictions on the sale of laptops, how can you do it on tobacco or sugar
mm-hmm.
or what have you?
Yeah. Well, that's true. Maybe it's, I would say the one difference is one you are utilizing for whatever purposes, and one you're ingesting inside your body.
Yeah.
So there is a differentiation that way.
After America's longest war in Afghanistan, it's whose name I always confuse with his city. We can talk to him in a minute. But
Kevin, will be right with you.
Yeah.
Hang on the line.
Our longest war in Afghanistan, despite years of international effort to reel back Afghanistan's opium culture, cultivation and production. Despite years of the effort to stop Afghanistan's opium culture, cultivation, this is the sentence, and production hit record levels this year, and programs to counteract them have floundered, according to a new United Nations study.
What he's talking about is the poppy plantations, basically, that they have there, and that is their big money maker, just like olives in certain countries, but this creates a heroin industry.
So let's see, 2013, a historic high, 500,000 acres. You know, it's funny. You would think that after all of this, that heroin consumption would be like way down, but I guess not.
No, and I've heard that it's up with younger teens.
Nice.
You know, I talk to kids. My next door neighbor's 17. He lets me. He keeps me in the know with what's going on with high school kids.
There you go. One of the things we talked about earlier was that Uruguay is going to legalize, or has probably by now, legalized marijuana. And comment on it from Kevin. Kevin is in Wayne. Kevin, hi. Welcome to the broadcast. Kevin. Kevin.
Hello?
Yeah, hi. You're on the air.
All right. My phone just kept on cutting out.
Okay.
I just wanted to talk about Uruguay. Finally, somebody's legalizing weed, and I just want to say that's a good thing. I mean, America needs to catch up. Been running.
You know how much we've spent on the war on drugs? Like $1 trillion trying to stop people, as John Sinclair once said, from smoking flowers. So they change their consciousness. Because you know what happens if you smoke marijuana? Well,
you might get a little hungry.
You get high. Yeah.
You might be maybe a little sleepy. Depends on the strain.
I never understood the idea that in order to protect ourselves from ourselves, that they were going to create this massive police and prison apparatus. So I figured they still arrest like a million people a year throughout the United States for marijuana usage. And the majority of people now finally think that this is just insane.
Ridiculous.
But the damage that has been done to people, it's not a war on drugs, really been a war on the American people, the people that want to get high on something other than the official drug that, billions are being made from, right? You are cutting out again, so
thanks for calling, Kevin.
As they used to say a long time ago, we're going to cut out. I can't, my mouse is not
there. Did you hear about those tunnels that they busted coming over from Mexico into California? These elaborate tunnels, systems, like that you saw on the show Weeds that used to be, Showtime?
Yeah.
That was a great show. And these are serious operations, and there's a lot of them. I don't know if it's hundreds, but there have been a lot of people, but they're busting them left and right.
Here's Paul. Paul, thanks for calling 248-544-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, guys.
Hi.
Yeah, I remember I quit smoking back in 1982, and I started in 1971 when I was 15, and I couldn't remember when I started smoking, it was 50 cents a pack. And kids in those days could actually go in a drugstore and buy cigarettes. And they had cigarette machines everywhere. And I quit back in 1982. I tapered off. I didn't quit cold turkey. And so it's been a long time. And I remember when I quit smoking in 82, it was like $1.75 a pack. And I thought that was outrageous at that time. So,
Now.
I'm surprised at two things. That since cigarette smoking is most prevalent among the poor and the working class, how they can actually pay the freight, and also one of the things they find when it gets to a certain level, there starts to be a lot of smuggling, right? But I don't know where they're going to smuggle them from now. Well, I'll tell you, in New York State, the Indian tribes. Well, there's one of the Indian tribes that straddles the United States and Canada, and a lot of cigarettes actually used to go to Canada because Canada always had this very high tax.
Can I mention about marijuana?
Sure, go ahead.
I think it was back in the 30s, the pharmaceutical industry got demonized because marijuana has tremendous medicinal purposes for glaucoma and cancer and things like that nature, and they didn't want it.
Well, you know what my opinion on it is, Paul? That even if it has no value whatsoever medicinally, it's no one's business but your own. Everybody ought to have full facts. Like, I'm completely libertarian on this. Including stuff like crack, very harmful, very stupid thing to use. But if you are in full knowledge of what this does, go for it.
I think everything should be legalized too. I'm with you on that. Because all it does, the black market just create a bunch of
criminals.
Makes millions of dollars for people that are just psychopathic people, and it just creates. And then we spend billions of dollars a year trying to, suppress the trafficking of it. It's stupid, and it's a waste of our tax dollars, but,
okay. You know what Livonia is spelled backwards?
What? I couldn't figure that one out.
Okay. All right. Gotta go. If I say it, I'll just go crazy laughing.
I'm trying to figure it out.
Anoville.
Oh, God.
Just a friend of mine from Livonia invited us to a party, and he said it's Anoville, backward. Mike from Troy's next. We're going to get you as soon as we come back from our break.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Riff. Peter and Jalee will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. The home of Dave and Chuck the Freak is WRIF.com. Find Dave and Chuck the Freak topics, videos, podcasts, and a few e-curiosities no fan should do without. Brought to you by Biker Bob's Harley Davidson of Taylor for a good time and a great ride. Exclusively at WRIF.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Jalee.
All right, thank you very much. Our final segment, 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743.
We haven't taken many emails tonight. Winston Smith, of course, the protagonist in 1984, could be him, writes, I'm surprised you aren't talking about the affluenza verdict, A-F-F-L-U-E-N-Z-A. I don't know what that is. Jolene is so hip to popular culture. She doesn't know what it is.
Well, it does sound vaguely familiar, but why don't you write us back and fill us in?
Yeah.
We don't know everything.
Yeah.
And I think there was someone complaining we don't let anyone talk, but that's a bunch of bull. We let everybody talk.
Yes.
Just call.
Call. Give us a call.
Let's talk.
All right. So let's go back to our phones. Here is Mike. Mike is in Troy. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going, Peter? Great show.
Thank you.
I've listened to you for a long time. You're doing great.
Thank you very much. What's up?
Hey, well, I wanted, you know, I can speak from experience on a few of the things that you guys are talking about, having been addicted to crack cocaine, starting out with alcohol, then to pot, then to cocaine. No heroin in my story, but anyway, through it all, smoked cigarettes, and I'm recovered now. I had about 8 years clean and sober from all drugs except for caffeine, and I also quit nicotine at that time. So I went 8-9 years without anything like that. And the having had to quit to live basically and get off drugs, the cigarettes were the hardest. It was just hard. I don't know and there's no reward system for cigarettes. You know,
right.
I never got anything from it, so it's kind of amazing to me that it's legal. And, you know, and with the marijuana, now I say I have 8 years clean and sober. I started smoking pot again, and it started with ingesting it like cookies.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that because I wasn't introducing smoke into my lungs. And I could say a lot of the addiction, you know, filling your lungs with smoke, as strange as that may seem, there's something to that. And I started eating some cookies, and now my cookie supply ran out. So now I have a little one-hitter, a bat in the dugout, as they used to say in the 70s.
Right.
And just one hit of that little tiny bit of marijuana is all I need through the day. I don't have any cravings to go smoke crack. I don't want to smoke an ounce of weed. It's like medicine. It's like just what I do now, and I'm okay with it. You know,
kind of an anti-anxiety.
Yeah, for whatever reason, ain't nobody's business. There's an old song from the 20s, ain't nobody's business if I do. And how are you hurting anyone? You're not. And if there's, demons attached to it, I mean, that's something that you and people around you have to deal with, not guys with guns and flak vests.
Right,
you know?
Right. I have a family. Under success, I consider myself a success. I got out of what I got out of alive and put together a long string of sobriety. And I really don't see anything wrong with one hit of marijuana a day. And anybody who says that's wrong or anything, you know, it's just who are they to say? You know,
exactly.
That's all I wanted to
say. I mean, there's great hypocrisy too. Well. Great, Mike. Always glad to hear a success story. Thanks.
Yeah,
thanks for telling us. Appreciate it.
Congratulations.
All right. Keep up the good work, you two.
Okay, and have a good night. Let's go on here to Anonymous. Hi, Anonymous. You're on the air. Welcome.
In Redford.
How are you doing?
We're good.
Yeah, I just want to touch on your conversation a little bit. First, I want to say, how are you recovered if you still have a one-hitter? I've been a drug addict for, most of my life. And, marijuana is a gateway drug. Like, it should not be tolerated in any shape, way, or form, in my opinion. And, little kids, around.
Well, you know what? Can you turn your radio completely off?
Okay.
Because we're getting this feedback. Yeah.
Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's just smoking should not be tolerated in, the world we live in today. Either if it be smoking cigarettes.
Well, I don't know what to make of that.
I don't either.
Yeah. Let's see. After a Texas teen from a wealthy family avoided jail time, many are wondering whether the case has set a precedent for affluenza, The affliction a psychologist cited in the trial.
I know what he's talking about now.
A psychologist testified that 16-year-old Ethan Couch, charged in the deaths of four pedestrians while driving drunk, suffered from the condition in which children, generally from richer families, have a sense of entitlement, are irresponsible, and make excuses for poor behavior because parents have not set proper boundaries. I got to get more to this story here.
Well, this happened. Have you been following this, Peter?
No. A judge gave the teen 10 years of probation for the fatal accident. Prosecutors were seeking the maximum 20-year prison sentence.
He killed four people, and he got probation.
Yeah. Details of the sentence, and you know, it's clear where.
If he were a 16-year-old black boy from the city of Detroit and that happened, see you later.
Yeah, I'd be very curious to see who he killed. So that's what that's all about. Hey, by the way, we were talking about Afghanistan and how it has not only cut back on its opium production, it's actually increased. But the other thing is, you think about the billions, hundreds of billions that go into supplying that war that continues over there, and the fact that we're talking about the people in this government are talking about being there for another 10 years.
And it's already the longest war.
Yeah. Facing a well-financed insurgency in Afghanistan. This is 10 years later. Facing a well-financed insurgency in Afghanistan. The United States has struggled for years to cut off the main contribution American taxpayers make to Taliban coffers. The hiring of Afghan contractors with ties to the insurgents. Think about this. Look at your paycheck. Think about all that it goes for that you don't want to. A lot of you think, it's just going to them, or it's going to go to some poor person I'm going to pay for their health insurance or their food stamps or something like that.
You just can't stand it.
And that is not where it's going, folks. At least these are our countrymen and women. We're talking here that our billions, tens of billions, hundreds of billions going out the door, mostly to American contractors, but also to Afghan contractors with ties to the Taliban. Because despite the development of contractor blacklists and other requirements earlier in the war, American investigators have uncovered a new case that casts doubt on the military's ability to weed out suspicious contractors from the thousands who work with the United States to build bases, ship supplies, and carry out many, many other tasks. I mean, think about this. Our tax dollars are going to build bases, ship supplies, and on and on and on like that. The case of the Zermatt Material Testing Laboratory, an Afghan company, was paid to do work on an American-controlled facility in November 2012, despite having been blacklisted 2 months before by one part of the military for providing bomb-making materials to the insurgents that they use against politicians to support the United States and also against our troops.
Such a huge racket. Well, yeah. It's like we have someone from Detroit who wants to talk about drogas.
About what?
Drugs.
Oh, what did you call it?
Drogas.
Drogas. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hey, hablas español, eh?
Yeah.
Here's Jamal in Detroit. Wait a minute, I don't think I did it. Hold on here. Let me click my magic plunker there. I think I got
I think you did.
Yeah. Hey, Jamal, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
We're good. What's up?
Oh, nothing. I just like to smoke weed.
Yeah. Turn your radio off, though, okay, because we're on a delay.
I want to hear myself on the radio. Radio!
We have a podcast, actually, that you can you can get at WRIF.com. You can listen to yourself tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. It helps me relax a lot, and I don't know. I feel like I'm a productive member of society when I'm on it. Society!
Okay.
Society.
All
thanks,
right.
Thanks, Jamal.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay.
Here's Larry in Fort Gratiot. Larry, hi. You're on the air.
Yeah. Very good radio show tonight. Very, very good.
Thank you.
And it is hard to quit smoking. And those cigarette things for the teenagers, that's a bunch of crap because they can get the regular cigarettes from older people, even from their family members and stuff.
Sure.
So that's a bunch of crap, too.
Yeah, people used to ask, you know, when I was 15, and we would just ask
some
adult.
Them.
Yeah. Well, no, we'd ask adults to buy them for him.
People just sold them to me. I had braces and everything, yeah.
Braces?
Yeah, like on my teeth.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant like from polio or something.
No. I did not have the polio.
Well, good. Good. Yeah.
I also like their comment about the anal thing, too.
Oh, Livonia
spelled backwards is Analville. Yeah, right.
Peter, well, you're so childish.
Well, that was a friend of mine from Livonia, but he's pretty childish. Maybe listening.
Well, I think
we've had him. He's been a guest on this show before.
He has?
Yeah.
Oh.
I'm not going to say
most of our friends are somewhat playful.
Yeah. I'm glad you didn't say childish.
No.
All right. Let's go way down south and pick up Jim in Alabama. Jim, hi. You're on the air.
How you doing tonight?
Very good.
Peter?
Yeah.
It's great to talk to you. I just called you because it's very concerning to me about the subject you're talking about. Here in Alabama, we have one of the highest incarceration rate of any democracy in the history of mankind.
Sure.
Our jails are at capacity. Our prisons are at a capacity of 190%. Most of these are a little trivial stuff. They will throw you in jail and lock you away forever. And the state is going bankrupt trying to house all of these mainly little minor cases of drugs. It is very harsh in the South. And over-criminalized on the subject of marijuana and minor offenses. You can go to jail for 20 years, 10 years, 15 years, and it's just like it's nothing. And what has happened is me and my friend, we're planning a lawsuit because, if you know this, California started doing the same thing, over-criminalizing with trivial drug cases. And they were at 160% of capacity at their prisons, and Alabama is at 190%. And me and my friend, we have did our research, and we're preparing to sue the state in order to try to decriminalize and bring some sanity back to somewhat of rational people or irrational people who feel like they can just put people away, ruin their lives on minor drug charges.
Well, what's the suit? What's your suit going to be based on? About
It's going to be based on overcrowding.
Okay, but can you do that? They always say there's a thing you have to have standing. I mean, if you're
Yes, we've got somebody with standing, and matter of fact, we had to go to a local college, and we're just a bunch of grassroots people who get a little funding together, and really we make a change here because most people will not do what we do.
That's
terrific. They stand in this ultra right wing conservative state, and we make the hard decisions and collect money and file a lawsuit. But the standing is, we'll find somebody withstanding because what they're doing is a very harsh. You remember the chain gangs we had here in the South? It is still just as brutal, outlandish, and ridiculously harsh. Particularly, these are not murderers.
Right.
These are not rapists or robbers. Really, a threat to society. But it's outlandish what we've done. We've over-criminalized the drug trade, and it is damaging our society. It's hurting families. It's destroying us, and it's basically bankrupting the state.
Well, yeah. So, well, that's what happened. You know, at first, one of the things that the drug law did was to provide clients for the prison industrial complex.
Because prisons have become privatized.
Well, just even for the, right. But now it's just becoming this enormous drain on the states, as you're indicating, Jim.
Yeah, but they're stacking people in jails that are designed for, let's say, 1,000 people, and they'll put 2,000 to 3,000 people in a prison.
That's awful.
Yeah.
And they have some of these people sleep on floors. It's like a third world country. Some of these people sleep on floors. It's dehumanized. You talk about Gitmo. Gitmo has nothing on Alabama's prisoners. It's outrageous. But stay tuned. You'll hear when we file this lawsuit because we found some people just to try to bring some sanity back because we can't afford to put people in prison, lock them up, and throw away the key forever. While the state goes bankrupt, we can't educate our kids, and we're on an endless cycle of not educating our kids and over-criminalizing society, and people are making money off of people going to prison.
Yeah, big money.
Jim, thanks for listening. Wait, how'd you ever find out about our show?
He's called us many times.
He has?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
All right. 248-544-WRIF. Here is Kim. Kim is in Warren.
About drugs before. That's probably
hi, Kim. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Kim.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Kim.
I'm a first-time caller, so welcome. I'm a little bit nervous.
Oh, don't be nervous.
And never confess publicly.
We're your friends.
Yeah. It's just like...
Okay. I'm calling from Warren. I'm just calling about, you guys talked about Fox News at the very beginning of your show. And my husband is a diehard Republican, and I'm a diehard independent.
Oh, my.
And he, you know, he's all about Fox News. And
how do you do it?
I go upstairs in my room and watch TV and listen to the radio. But, you know, I get to hear a lot of the BS on there. And I agree with you, Julian. There are a bunch of Barbie dolls on there. But the thing that really pissed me off.
Barbie doll porn stars.
The thing that really made me mad the most about that show is, you know, Bill O'Reilly, he is such a pompous jerk. And the way he talks to these women, you know, he calls them by their last names. And when I first started watching it, I was like, what is up with that? You know, why is he calling them, you know, like Kelly and Crowley and whoever they are? Why do they call them by their names, you know?
Right.
I mean, all the guys, use their first names, or he'd even call them, like, Mr. Rove, Kyle Rove. I mean, I can think of a lot of other names to call him.
Sure.
Well, I'll tell you what, the fact that we're even talking about that Bill O'Reilly may disrespect women, no big shocker here, right?
Yeah, he had some big, I can't remember what that was.
There was some lawsuit.
Hey, but you know what, Kim, what do you think about this? You know, say to your husband, hey, let's do this one night or every half hour. We'll watch MSNBC together, and then I will watch Fox News with you.
World War II.
And then we'll talk about which.
I don't watch it anymore. I watched it for a little while, and I said, I can't even watch this.
Well, I can't either.
It's so disgusting, and just being a woman, I can't watch that.
How long have you been married? How long have you been married, Kim?
You know what? Today is our 18th anniversary.
Wow. A long time now. Did you know 18 years ago that this was where he leaned?
I knew he was Republican, but I didn't know it was this bad.
But you still, love him.
Yes, I do.
That's good.
I mean, you know,
I'm giving you major props, Kim. Major props coming from me. Major.
Thank you, Julian. I appreciate
all right,
that.
Kim.
But, you know, he listens to Bob Duco every day, I mean, it's just, it's.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and Rush Limbaugh.
How does he have all this time?
He's retired.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell him that he should get out of the house a little.
Yeah. Get out of the house a lot.
Yeah. All right, Kim, thank you very much.
Okay, guys.
Appreciate your call.
Kim, call us again, okay?
All right.
Have a happy Xmas.
Yes, we will. And tell your husband we say hello.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll do that.
All right.
Let him know those crazy lefties say hello.
Yeah. Have say happy holidays and keep the X in Xmas. Only because, again, we're not trying to insult Christians
or the real consumerism versus
it really is Xmas. And real Christians, devout Catholics, Christians, other people that celebrate it as a religious holiday ought to be saying, okay, we are celebrating Christmas because it is a Christian holiday of which, and we're going to go to church and mass and all that.
Yeah.
And over there is Xmas, which is just about buying electronics.
I mean, and it is out of control, let me tell you.
Yeah.
When I was married, my ex-mother-in-law, she was an example of a Christian who that's how that she celebrates. It is about church for her.
And that's Christmas.
She's there for days in a row.
Yeah.
And, you know, she pops in and we have a dinner and then she goes back, back then. It's all over now. So.
Yeah. But people that have a pagan tree.
I've done that.
In their living room and have the Yule log, which is Yule, which is the pagan holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And what about all that other stuff, all that other kind of pagan stuff that's all about it. I don't know. A lot of the story of Christmas, I got to tell you, is taken from other religions. That's true. For sure. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Let's get Harry. Harry's on the line. Harry, hey, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good. What's up?
I just wanted to piggyback off your earlier comment. I love MSNBC. And I also just wanted to, you know, say that that Anielville comment was hilarious.
What was?
The Anielville comment.
Oh, Anielville.
Yeah. Peter, it's been a hit.
Livonia spelled backwards. Yeah, it was Anielville.
That was hilarious. What you guys doing for Christmas this year?
Well, you know what? I'll tell you. I interviewed a guy one time.
I don't celebrate Christmas.
I interviewed an atheist who wrote a book called The Trouble with Christmas. And I said, so what do you do on Christmas? He said, we'll go to the office. I'm going, ooh.
That's what I do.
I'm going to take the day off. Yeah. So I don't know. What are we going to do?
Nothing.
Go to a movie, have friends. We usually go to Christmas Eve parties, Christmas Day parties.
Don't you have Chinese food?
But those are Xmas things. Have nothing to do. They're not, you know, it's nothing to do with Christ, a mass for the birth of Christ, as is portrayed in the Christian religion. It has to do with a period that historically, beginning with the pagan observance around that time, of, you know, celebrating this season of getting together with family and friends and what have you. So in that regard, I look forward to it. What are you going to do, Harry? Have an electronic cigarette?
I was raised a Jehovah's Witness, so I don't get to celebrate Christmas.
Yeah.
I'm sad.
You're still in that?
Yeah, I am. Uh-huh. Going on 30 years.
Well, if you're sad, then you don't have to be. There are other choices.
What? Yeah.
I mean, my parents and my family threatened to, you know, disown me if I did it.
Wow.
Oh, that makes me sad.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know, it's a hard time. I shot my leg off.
We got a group of... Funny with that. I think that's the third call. Hey, thanks for the laugh, though, yeah. There. Yeah. Harry, a.k.a. whatever your real name is.
Right, yeah. Okay.
He shot his leg off.
Harry's from Anielville.
From Anielville because his parents will let him. Oh, God. Sometimes these shows end on a really down
note. All right,
note.
Well, here's what we got. I didn't think that was down.
Well, I mean, you know,
a fake call?
It wasn't serious.
What the hell?
Hey, through the years.
I mean, there are people in that identical spot that feel uncomfortable with
so
what
they shoot
their
leg off? No, they're not.
All right. Coming up, I have an interview. Boy, we haven't talked about abortion in a long time, but I'm going to be doing it.
There's a cheery subject for you.
Yeah, with Sarah Erdrich. She's written a book called Generation Roe, having to do with Roe v. Wade.
Yes.
And everything that a woman's right to choose is facing now. And also a reexamination of this strike that went on in Detroit from 1995 to 2000, the great newspaper strike against Detroit News, and guy's written a book about it, so we're going to have that on. So let's see. What the hell is the date now? I came in 16th, 15th today?
Right.
Like?
It's right there.
What
is
it
now
say?
The 16th of
the
December.
The 16th. All right. So, yeah. So we're not going to be affected by Christmas or
New Year's.
Or New Year's.
We're going to be here. Yeah. It'll be iffy if I am or not. I'm just forewarning you. I know. Don't give me the squinted eye look. But I'm working. I'm doing like about 15, 16 days. In a row on the air.
You can be rocking and rolling.
I am.
All right. Hey, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling, Jefferson. Thanks for taking the calls, and stay tuned for the interviews.
You're listening to the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. WRIF HD1 Detroit. The 12 days of Rhythmus are back. Keep listening for your next chance to win. Details online at WRIF.com. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. We're going to have a discussion about abortion. And this was something I was going to introduce by way of saying this has sort of been off the agenda. Certainly not here, not for a lot of women, and not certainly not for these groups that are trying to restrict abortions and for the groups that are trying to keep pro-choice the way available for women. But suddenly in Michigan, the legislature, the Republican-dominated legislature, has put restriction on abortion in health plans. And this has just been passed. It was brought up simultaneously in the House and Senate. The Democrats in the state of Michigan, in the House and Senate, are crying foul. And what this will require is women will have to buy additional insurance if they want abortion coverage in their health insurance plans. And this passed the Michigan legislature, and it will become law without the governor's signature. Well, this is a perfect time to join Sarah Erdrich. And she has written Generation Roe, Inside the Future of the Pro-Choice Movement. I think it's got some real challenges, and we'll find out from Sarah Erdrich. And Sarah Erdrich is a leading pro-choice activist. She's been named that by Newsweek and has written extensively on abortion rights, and it's been printed in any number of publications. Sarah Erdrich, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, there's a book, I think, I'm trying to think of the author, Walter Mosley. It's called Always Outnumbered, Always Outgunned. Is this the state that you find yourself in these days, being pro-choice?
You know, it's definitely been a lot more challenging. I think a lot of those of us that support reproductive rights for both men and women would not have expected that 40 years after Roe v. Wade, so many of the battles are still being fought all over this country.
How do you feel that the people that are anti-abortion, I usually call them, to be provocative, the compulsory pregnancy movement, they call themselves right to life, and that sort of gains the moral high ground just in the initial description?
Which I think is interesting, and I will give the anti-choice movement my preferred terminology, but I will give them credit for being very savvy with their messaging. Because you're right that pro-choice and pro-life, those terms are often used to describe the two general sides of this issue, but those are misnomers. You know, I consider myself someone who is in favor of life. I'm an environmentalist. I oppose the death penalty. I'm a vegetarian. But I also believe that a woman who is pregnant should be able to make the decision that's best for herself and her family regarding that pregnancy. So I think that I think a lot of people, even those who may not want to choose abortion for themselves personally, still would not necessarily want to see that choice taken away from someone else. I think a lot of people are perhaps more pro-choice than they may initially think if you just go by these very general, broad terms.
Mm-hmm. This bill that just passed the Michigan House and Senate, which says now that women will have to get riders, essentially, separate health policies to cover abortion. The Democrats have said that they would like it to go to a referendum. But that always is challenging as well, isn't it? Because frequently, I mean, I don't like the idea of people's rights being put up to a popular vote. I mean, what if you want to put slavery back on the ballot or take away women's right to vote or something like that? I mean, who wants to have their rights determined by the majority?
I agree, and I think that it's been interesting to chart what's been going on in Michigan in terms of this battle, because I find it so interesting that just last year the Republican governor vetoed very similar legislation. And generally, I mean, in my understanding, it's been a while since I've lived in Michigan, but my understanding is that Governor Snyder is not particularly in favor of reproductive rights, of women being able to choose abortion. So if an anti-choice conservative governor vetoes this measure for the anti-choice groups in Michigan to come right back with it, that's a lot of chutzpah, and I'm honestly very surprised that they were able to push this through.
Well, the anti-choice movement, I guess my choice of phrase of choice, the compulsory pregnancy movement, is too much of a mouthful, so we'll stay with anti-choice. My guest is Sarah Erdrich. She's written Generation Row, Inside the Future of the Pro-Choice Movement. It's published by Seven Stories Press, and we'll give you some web links to all of that as we go along. The anti-choice movement claims, why would you want a choice in terms of a human life? We're talking about a deeply ethical issue in which they ascribe personhood to a fetus. And in the extreme of it, they will say that abortion is murder. You're taking a human life. So the idea of a choice just doesn't ring well.
And that's true, and I think that really gets to just how complicated an issue this can be, and that's not really explored adequately enough, I think, in our national discourse. You know, if you truly believe that life begins at conception and that anything resulting from that is a human life, that is, in effect, a shutdown argument. I think that would be, I would not expect someone who believes that to ever support the idea of abortion rights. But I think, again, for a lot of people in this country, I think what they believe, and I'm speaking for myself as well, is that there is more of a gray area. You know, I was raised in the Jewish faith, and in Judaism, life does not begin until a fetus, a baby, can draw breath. So that's a very different idea of when life begins. So for me personally, I do not think that abortion is murder. I think that when a baby can live independently of the woman, then it is a person. I think before then it is part of the woman. And as such, that the woman's health, the woman's body, and what is going on in her life really should be the foremost concerns in deciding whether or not to continue a pregnancy.
That's interesting. Again, go ahead.
I was going to say, again, like I said, I think that I know that just answering like that makes me sound like I'm qualifying things a lot. So I think that does get to how complicated an issue this is, that for a lot of people, okay, if you really truly believe that life begins at conception, don't choose abortion. That's fine. No one is forcing anyone to have an abortion. No one should. But to say that just because you believe something means that everyone else should live by your beliefs, that's what I have a problem with. That's where I think you're crossing a line and saying, I believe this, and I'm going to tell you what to do with your life. I don't think that that's appropriate.
It's interesting you cite the Judaic tradition, because because a lot of the anti-choice ideas are rooted in religion as well. But what they're asking for is a legal determination that a woman does not have a right to choose abortion. And yet in Anglo-American jurisprudence, there's no basis whatsoever to see a fetus as a full human being. You can't legally name a fetus. It cannot inherit property. I mean, all the things that one ascribes to personhood. So they're sort of hoeing new ground in many ways, trying to bring. And am I correct? Is this mostly religiously motivated anti-choice ideas?
A great deal of it is. And it's interesting. If you look at kind of the modern iteration of the anti-choice movement in this country, a lot of it really did come up in the late 1970s, early 1980s, around the election of Ronald Reagan, which was driven in large part by the evangelical movement. So there are definitely strong ties between anti-choice ideology and these very particular branches of religions that do tend to be more in the Christian faith, more evangelical, Catholic, and so forth.
You know, I do a phone-in talk show as well, and we actually, the reason I was saying at the beginning, this had kind of got out of the idea of abortion, had kind of dropped in from at least the mainstream considerations. I know the groups defending choice and the groups opposing it, that's still a high priority. But people just haven't been calling in about it. And I know that when I've had these arguments in the past and have said many of the same things that you've eloquently said, that at the end they'll say, well, they got themselves into it. So at the end of this all, isn't there a whole element of sexual repression and anti-woman as well?
Very much. I think there's a huge strain of misogyny and of it really, I think, shows just how confused our country still is about sexuality, about pregnancy, and about motherhood. I think you see so many people who are anti-choice, but who would not necessarily be in favor of paid maternity leave for all women, who would not necessarily be in favor of universal pre-K education, you know, who really just look at this one very specific, very emotional issue and ignore the realities that go along with raising a child in our country. And I think that that also goes back to, you know, before the child is born to pregnancy, this idea that if a woman has sex and becomes pregnant, of course she should carry the child to term. You know, it's this idea that if a woman doesn't, she's denying some sort of, you know, impulse, that she's not a real woman. And but in those, besides the fact that those kinds of discussions are very sexist, it also ignores the roles of the man involved. You know, so much of this, so much of when we talk about abortion, we talk about reproductive rights, is about women. But men are affected by unplanned pregnancies as well. Men are affected by not having access to reproductive health care. And men are affected by their partners carrying a pregnancy, who want to continue a pregnancy but have health issues. Or the when the fetus is diagnosed with severe defects, which happens. So I think by just focusing on women, it really does show this sort of puritanical strain that is still at play in our society.
The book is Generation Row, Inside the Future of the Pro-Choice Movement. My guest is Sarah Erdrich. She has written this for Seven Stories Press. You can go to sevenstories.com, a wonderful imprint, a lot of great books there. Sarah has her own website. Her last name is spelled E-R-D-R-E-I-C-H. So it's sarahurdrich.com, I believe, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
And mine, I will have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. One of the things I don't understand is sometimes the anti-choice people will say we oppose all abortions except in cases of rape or incest and probably some other sometimes some other qualifications. I mean, if it's whereas some of the crazies have said even if you're impregnated, as was a Michigan state senator, Gretchen Whitmer, that's God's will, or that's still a human being. I mean, how can you make those exceptions? I think they realize politically, if you make no exceptions, you lessen your political chances of limiting the availability of abortion.
And I think that speaks to this idea, that there's such a thing as a quote-unquote good abortion. And it goes back to what we were just talking about, this idea of women and their sexuality, that if a woman becomes pregnant and she, without her consent, then it's okay to get an abortion. And look, I support women who want to get abortions as if they become pregnant through rape or incest, but I also think that a woman should not have to go through such a horrible circumstance in order for her abortion to be judged worthwhile. You know, I think that any woman that says this is not the right time for me to have a pregnancy, this is not the right time for me to become a mother, I think that her judgment and her opinion should be trusted because she is the one who would have to go through the pregnancy and raise that child. So while you do see a lot of these rape and incest exemptions, and also occasionally an exemption for the health of the mother, although that can be incredibly subjective in terms of what actually would threaten a woman's health enough to terminate a pregnancy, while I'm glad that these exemptions do exist, the very fact of them really perpetuates this idea that only some women deserve to have the right to do, to make this decision for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very troubling.
Sir Erdrich, in your book, Generation Row, as has been our conversation, so much of it is a defense of pro-choice, and which says something. So the pro-choice movement is on the defensive, and I was thinking the questions that I still have in my mind are ones where you would have to make similar defenses. What's happening inside of the pro-choice movement? Who's This is kind of a wide-ranging question, but who's in it, and how, what's its strength and its unity and its political impact? Are people? It always seems that the politicians are listening to the anti-choice movement. Do they listen to the pro-choice movement?
They do, definitely. I think there are obviously more some politicians that are more more willing to consider the pro-choice movement and to consider that. That perspective, but I think that there are those politicians on both sides of the aisle. You know, while the Democratic Party is more aligned with and more connected with the pro-choice movement, I think that there are also Republican politicians that support this more common sense and realistic approach to women's reproductive health. That said, I think the movement is interesting. I think that as with any social movement, you have the mainstream groups that do work more closely, perhaps with politicians, with donors, and so forth. And then you have the grassroots, more independent activists as well. So I think it's a very large movement. But while a lot of it is based in Washington, D.C. around politics, I think that the most interesting and the most impactful work is being done on the ground in communities all over the country about getting out and talking to people and educating people. I think that's one of the strengths of the pro-choice movement is being able to connect pregnancy rights to the larger reproductive right continuum. And when I say pregnancy rights, I don't just mean the right to have an abortion, but also the right for women who want to stay pregnant to have these workplace protections, to have access to good prenatal care. And I think the pro-choice movement can have a very large umbrella around women's reproductive health and men's reproductive health in ensuring that individuals are able to make the best choices for themselves and their families, whether that's to stay pregnant, to continue a pregnancy, or to terminate.
Here is just a little story that suggests a couple of things. Every time there's an attack on Planned Parenthood, and it was getting expensive for us, my wife and I would give $50 to Planned Parenthood. And one of the things you do when you give to any group, then they send you endless mail that almost is going to eat up your donation. So I remember the first time I walked into Planned Parenthood to do that in Ferndale, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit. Here, and I walked in by myself, and I could just tell the level. There was a slight level of nervousness. Let's see what this guy is up to. Here's a man, you're by himself walking in, so I gave him $50 in cash, and they said, "Can we get your name?" I said, "Nope." And so I've come now. Every time they see me, they give me a big smile, you know, because they know I'm going to be giving them money. But the militancy of the anti-choice people is suggested by the first reaction. Here's a man walking into a Planned Parenthood, and so there's the ragged edge of the anti-choice movement are terrorists. Is that still a factor?
Very much. Very much. I think there is still a friends component to the anti-choice movement that truly is that violence is the only effective and worthwhile way to make their point. And that's incredibly dangerous. And that puts a lot of people's lives in danger. It's only been 4 years since Dr. George Tiller was shot in Kansas. And
assassinated.
When you had sat in his church. A new clinic has opened in Wichita on the site of his former clinic. That staff, that doctor, they are harassed. The building has been picketed. You know, this is something that is not going away. And I know there was a wonderful documentary that was recently released called After Killer.
Right.
Which examined 4 providers in this country that are public about the fact that they do later term abortions. All of them have their own stories about what they and their staff and their families and their communities have gone through because they do this work. And it's, you know, I remember years ago, I went to a Planned Parenthood in Charleston, South Carolina. And I thought I was pregnant. I wanted to get, you know, a pregnancy test from somewhere I could trust. So I went to the Planned Parenthood. And I was so taken aback by the fact that the security guard at the front desk had a gun. You know, I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was shocked.
Welcome home.
Shocked to see that. Thank you. But you know, that really, and so to me, that was kind of much like with your experience. That was my and this was in 2001, this was when I was, years before I really entered this field, but for me, as someone who grew up in the 1980s and 90s in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, this was eye-opening. It really brought home to me that not everyone has the luxury of taking access to safe health care for granted.
Yeah.
And that stayed with me all these years.
A friend of ours, a doctor in Missouri, and was performing abortions, a woman, and she was going into a different city from where she lived, and she was met by police cars, had to put on bulletproof armor. And finally, she said, I just can't take it anymore. They found out where she lived in another city, began making threatening calls. And, finally, she said to us, do you think I'm awful that I've stopped? She said, I just can't take this anymore. And, of course, we said no. One of the more insidious, it doesn't get more insidious than terrorism and pro-life people using terrorist and methods of assassination and intimidation. But another ominous little deal is that in many ways, Sarah Erdrich, you would be kind of a poster woman for what the anti-choice movement says. New York, white, Jewish, middle class, and that the idea that this is sort of a Holocaust against black children. I've seen that recently. I'm sure you have as well. And there's strains of big strains of anti-Semitism in it as well.
Yes. And I have to say, whenever I hear any anti-choice use of the term the Holocaust and to describe abortion, my skin crawls. And
sure.
I always think of, I'm going to mess up the quote, but Elie Wiesel, there's a quote from him that essentially says, anyone who compares abortion to the Holocaust proves how little they know about either abortion or the Holocaust. You know, it's such an ignorant comparison to make. And in terms of the black genocide, quote unquote, that a lot of the more radical anti-choice groups, this idea that they put across, I always think of, for my book, one of the providers I interviewed is Dr. Willie Parker. He's an amazing physician. I know he has been doing work in Mississippi in the last abortion clinic that is still open in that state. And when I interviewed him, he was living and working in Washington, D.C. And he said, you know, this idea that Planned Parenthood is targeting black children, black families, black women, everywhere in Washington, D.C. is a black neighborhood. You know, they said the majority of black. He said, the meaning I took from that is, should Planned Parenthood just not operate in D.C.? You know, like, what point are they trying to make, that black women shouldn't have access to health care, that only that Planned Parenthood and reproductive health clinics should only operate in certain neighborhoods? I find that idea so insulting to African-Americans, to black women and families, that they can't be trusted to make their own decisions about what's best for them in terms of their health care.
Sarah Erdrich, do this. We have about 30 seconds left. Let's leave with something positive. The right of women to choose is still enshrined in law. What's positive, and what kind of positive outlook do you bring in your book?
The fact that there are so many fantastic and really empowered activists working across this country and getting communities, getting their friends, getting people who might not think about about reproductive rights if they relate to their own life, getting a lot of awareness raised, and a lot of people are becoming more aware of what's going on. I think that that's one of the silver linings to all these attacks on women's rights, is that you've seen a lot of people who thought, wait, Roe v. Wade was supposed to settle this, that they're becoming engaged, they're becoming active, and they're saying, I want to have the right to make these decisions for myself. I don't want someone who's never met me, who doesn't know my life, to tell me what to do. And I think that that sort of activism, that sort of empowerment is so amazing. And I think that that's a really positive sign for the future.
Well, thank you so much. The book, Generation Roe, pardon me, Inside the Future, the Pro-Choice Movement. My guest has been Sarah Erdrich. The book is published by Seven Stories Press. You can go to sevenstories.com. Sarah's website is Sarah Erdrich, which is E-R-D-R-E-I-C-H, there'll be, .com. And there'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Sarah, thanks so much for being on the broadcast.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call. Night Call.
I try to find the right one, but it seems like they all just have one thing on their mind.
Having only one thing on your mind can be a good thing when you find that special someone. At Geico.com, that someone is a car insurance policy. And the only thing on its mind is being your soulmate. Depend on easy online tools for paying bills and managing claims. Picture a life of savings as you gaze into the eyes of a free rate quote. That's our go-to move. Geico. 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
You hear the phrase a lot this time of year, Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays. But holidays are not always happy, particularly for guys grappling with a divorce they didn't choose. Suddenly these husbands and dads are thrust onto battlefields where the fate of everything they care about will be decided. In the meantime, many must await the outcome in someone else's home this holiday season. These men need more than the help of a good lawyer. They need the hope and encouragement of a good friend. Chances are I've described someone that you count among your friends. Be sure and remember him this season.
The attorneys at Cordell & Cordell work to help men maximize their role in their children's lives, which includes protecting men's financial means to do so. Call the domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell, a partner men can count on. Offices in Troy, Novi, and now in Ann Arbor, 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. If you would have gone by my house between 1995 and 2000, you would have seen a sign on the lawn that said, "No Detroit News or Detroit Free Press wanted here." Both of our cars had bumper stickers supporting the Great Detroit newspaper strike that occurred in that period. This was when the workers went out on strike, and we're going to get a little precision in terms of that definition, in protest of what was happening to the two daily newspapers in Detroit. An incredible book has just been published about it. It's called The Broken Table, the Detroit Newspaper Strike and the State of American Labor. It's written by Chris Romberg, and Chris Romberg is an associate professor of sociology in Fordham University. We're reaching him in his office in New York City. Chris Romberg, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Well, this was an incredible strike like most modern memory. It's probably gone from all of those except those who participated in it. And I should say, well, I guess I did full disclosure, both being a union member and also just my sense of social justice. I was involved as a supporter quite consistently in those 5 years. But I wonder if you could just give us a summary so those that either pardon me, don't remember it or don't know about it, we'll know what we're talking about in your book, The Broken Table.
Okay, sure. Well, the Detroit newspaper strike was actually one of the largest and longest strikes over the last several decades. It was larger and longer than more than 95% of other strikes during that period. And it involved both newspapers, the Detroit News and the Free Press, and their corporate parents. And just briefly, on July 13th, 1995, the unions representing some 2,500 workers went on strike against the papers and their joint operating agency, the Detroit Newspaper Agency. So that involved members of six local unions, including journalists, printers, press operators, circulation workers, janitors, truck drivers, all walked off to their jobs after contract negotiations broke down. Centered around union charges of bad faith bargaining by the employers. The newspapers took a hard line and hired permanent replacements for the strikers and effectively militarized their operations. Altogether, the company spent an estimated $40 million on private security forces and paid out more than $1 million to suburban municipalities to cover police overtime at their production and distribution sites.
Do you think it was fair to say, Chris Rumberg, that the newspapers realized that a new day was dawning and the unions, Gaia bless them, but didn't?
Well, the way I portray it in the book, in The Broken Table, was that it's really a clash of institutional logics. That is, the newspapers were pursuing the corporate anti-union agenda that really became prominent in the 1980s, and the unions were trying to defend the principles of New Deal-style collective bargaining. So the two sides were really playing by different rules.
Well, and what I meant by that, and maybe you could expand on it, the unions had a model, and you talk about it in your book, The Broken Table, had a model, as you say, from the New Deal, where there was negotiations and compromise, and each side realized they had to give a little. But ultimately, at the end of a labor dispute, the unions would be intact, the corporations would have to maybe give a little more each time. But that, as you say, that's not the playbook that the newspapers were going by. They saw a new era.
It's true. I mean, in the current system, you could say that one side comes to the table looking to make a deal. That's the unions. Well, the other side comes looking to get rid of the table. It illustrates the impact of the rise of this corporate and legal anti-union regime. And workers have effectively lost the right to strike in the United States. For the sake of the country, I argue, I think we need to get it back.
Well, you mentioned, I believe, how few strikes there are any longer. We always think about all during my youth and growing up and all of that, and being part of a union, a broadcasters union, even to the point where there was a strike here one time years ago. We kind of took those for granted, but as I said, that increasingly that's part of an era gone by. There's just not strikes like there used to be, and not really any mass strikes of the nature of the Detroit newspaper strike that went on from 1995 to 2000.
Well, that's true. During the 1970s, there were an average of 289 major work stoppages involving 1,000 or more workers that occurred annually in the U.S. By the 1990s, that number had fallen to about 35 a year, and in 2009, there were no more than 5. And I think this is important because the right to strike was a crucial part of the system of democratic workplace government under the National Labor Relations Act, which was affirmed by the right to strike was affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1960 that said what you were explaining, that the right to strike is the last resort, but it was essential to maintaining the integrity of the bargaining process.
The decline
of unionization over the past couple of decades has been a major factor in the rise of American economic inequality, the distance between rich and poor now. But more than that, I think the political consequences are just as important. The loss of workers' right to bargain collectively in strike represents a significant de-democratization, as I call it, of American society in the workplace and in the community.
Well, besides employers, probably there's even some people that are in the middle class or the working class that would say, well, you know what? I mean, strikes create inconvenience for everyone. Just look at what happens like in England and France. You got general strikes and you can't get a bus or the food service is out and, or the garbage isn't being picked up. Maybe this is good. Maybe this works a little better. So we have less commotion in our society.
Well, sure, and that's the way it's often presented in the news media. I mean, what you hear about when you hear about reports about strikes are, how hard it is to get a flight or something like that, just the inconvenience to the consumer. But I think it has a greater underlying importance in terms of both the economic and political consequences. Like I said, the decline of unionization has been shown to be a significant factor in the rise of income inequality in this country, which has increased over the last couple of decades. But even more than that, it's a problem of there are fewer and fewer ways to hold companies accountable. That's why I call the book The Broken Table. That is, the ways in which workers and even members of the community could bring companies, large corporations, to the table and negotiate the conditions in terms of their employment and the consequences of companies' actions. Those things have been eroded.
Chris Rumberg is my guest. He's an associate professor of sociology at Fordham University. His book is The Broken Table, The Detroit Newspaper Strike and the State of American Labor. It's published by the Russell Sage Foundation. You can go to Russell Sage, that's SAGE.org. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Chris Romberg, how do you, I mean, what made you want to study this? And I mean, do you have a Detroit connection, or what signaled this might be a book worth writing and an issue worth pursuing?
Well, I actually lived in Michigan at the time for a brief period. I taught at Michigan State University from 1996 to 1997. So I was aware of the events as they were happening. And I do my research on urban social movements. My first book was called No, They're There, and it was a book about a social and political history of Oakland, California. So this is the kind of stuff that I do, and I was interested in. Had a few connections to the case. I actually attended the large demonstration there in 1997. So it seemed to me the kind of dramatic, really epic urban struggle that really shows the kind of conflicting forces that exist in our society. And I'm actually a union member myself. I'm a member of the National Writers Union, and when I was in graduate school, I was part of my teaching assistants union, which was affiliated with the United Auto Workers.
So we're union brothers. I'm a member of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, and that's full disclosure. Sure. And as I said at the beginning of the program, I was a supporter of all of the newspaper strikers and took part in many of the actions that Chris Romberg relates in The Broken Table, including the mass demonstration in 1997. But let's do this. Usually, and if people, you know, again, if their memory is not quite like mine since I was involved in it, or don't even know about the newspaper strike from 1995 to 2000, this wasn't just 30 guys, picketing out in front of one little place. This took on mass proportions and incredible community support. And Chris Romberg, I wonder if you could lay a little of that out of how that how that worked to the benefit of the strikers and actually, I guess, in a way, prolong the strike because the workers were not willing to give up given the support that they had.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that makes the case very interesting and unusual is, first of all, you had six local unions involved, and they all struck together. That doesn't happen all the time. And also that it was such a public strike because it was the newspapers, and it was spread over all the entire Detroit metropolitan area. It's not like you just had one plant going on strike. It was, every single distribution point, every warehouse, the two newsrooms downtown. So it was really very much a public event in Detroit history. And you're right about the community campaign. The unions organized a circulation and advertising boycott. They did civil disobedience and protest actions, and they even published their own alternative weekly strike paper called the Detroit Sunday Journal. Many people in the community rallied to their support. Prominent area civic, political, and religious figures stepped forward and urged a settlement, and circulation of the papers dropped by as much as a third. By their own estimate, the two papers lost a combined $92 million in the first 6 months.
That didn't stop them, though, did it? It was sort of an investment in the future, I think they saw it as.
Yeah, well, I don't think the companies expected to drop $92 million in
first.
I think they were very surprised by the amount of resistance that that came up. But you have to bear in mind these were owned by the two largest newspaper chains at the time, which were Gannett, which owns USA Today, for example, and Knight Ritter. And so these were companies that had extremely deep pockets. And once they got into it, they just decided to bull their way through, I think.
Well, tell us some about the transformation, because that's what really struck me of the strikers themselves. I mean, these were sort of real average in the best sense, and maybe model. Maybe that's what average always sounds a little pejorative. Model American citizens who worked hard, except for the journalists, were working class jobs, but with pay that allowed them to live a middle class life. And when I spoke to them, most of them said, "I'd never done anything like this in my life before."
Oh, sure. I mean, in many ways, well, one thing that was really interesting to me was the diversity of the employees who were involved and the solidarity they showed. That is, everyone, you know, from janitors to truck drivers to skilled craftspersons, you know, the press operators, to the white-collar professionals in the newsroom. The people who were on the picket line together really bonded in a way that was really extraordinary. And although the newspapers made a real effort to try to divide people and to make the journalists especially cross the picket line, you know, for those who stayed out, you know, many of them saw this as really a defense of their professional status, you know, that it wasn't really about the wages. It was really about the control of the workplace and the nature of the collective bargaining relationship. That's probably a point I should make, too, and that is that the strike was not really about wages at all. It was really about the future of the bargaining relationship between the papers and the unions. That is, the unions formally struck over three principal unfair labor practice charges related to bad faith bargaining that were issued by the National Labor Relations Board. Now, you could ask, why would there be such a big strike over such apparently procedural issues, right? But they were crucially important. Some of management's contract proposals would have effectively bypassed the unions or undermined their capacity for collective bargaining. Others were going to cut union jobs and replace them with lower-paid non-union labor. So the unions saw these proposals as an effort to radically reduce their presence in the workplace, and to agree to them would have been an invitation to slow suicide. So I think the companies were trying to fundamentally change the relationship between themselves and their workers. And the unions felt that this was really a do-or-die struggle, and the employees, the strikers, went out for that reason, not really for the dollars and cents on the table, but to protect their rights.
And though the newspaper strike began in 1995, in many ways it presaged what we're facing today with the right for collective bargaining. I mean, that's they anticipated what we're going to be facing. My guest is Chris Romberg. He's written The Broken Table, The Detroit Newspaper Strike, and The State of American Labor. And this is about the great, we always call it here in Detroit, the great newspaper strike from 1995 to 2000. And Chris, in your book, The Broken Table, you take us back to this very dramatic night of Labor Day, 1995, and I wonder if you could recount that. I just said that, and a chill just went down my back because I was there.
Sure. Well, Labor Day 1995 was really just a couple of months into the strike. The strike started in July. But it became really the first major mass confrontation between the unions, the strikers, and the companies, who were allied with the Sterling Heights police. The major printing plant, I should say, for the newspapers was in Sterling Heights, Michigan, and that became the site of many of the most dramatic confrontations. So you were there, and you probably could say as much about it as I could. Over the course of the weekend, then, there were several dramatic incidents of clashes between police and strikers. But what I should mention is that the companies had basically enlisted the Sterling Heights Police Department early on. As early as January 1995, the company had started reaching out to the police departments, and that was 6 months before the strike even began, and well before negotiations even began. So that the companies then...
Well, there was virtually pitched battles, wasn't there?
There were. Yeah. The police were arresting people for unlawful assembly. But it basically became just a way to disperse the picket line. And so the county prosecutor at the time, in effect the district attorney, Carl Marlinga, then had to issue a letter telling the Sterling Heights Police Department that, you know, you can't arrest someone for just standing there. Right, you know, this is a violation of First Amendment rights and the National Labor Relations Act, so it really became an incident in which the police department, as I argue in the book, was acting as an arm of the company.
They called, it was on Mound Road, and there was this big island, or what do we call it? I don't know, a boulevard. So, but, and the police, I don't know, I might have missed this in your book. The police referred to the island as Treasure Island.
Right.
Because they were making over $100,000 a year with all this overtime, so they were kind of delighted.
Yeah, that's another point to mention too. Actually, is that once the strike got started, then the police were spending an awful lot of time there, and the city was spending a lot of money to pay for the police and the overtime, and so they went to the companies, and the companies agreed to pay all those expenses, so that the city would send memos to the newspaper agency documenting, you know, or itemizing the exact amount that they had spent. And the companies would send a check to the city
for the exact amount
right down to the penny. And this went on for over a year.
Well, just so we don't let our time get too far away from us, Labor Day 1995, there's hundreds and hundreds of union workers and their supporters, people like me and people from other unions, United Auto Workers, steel workers, iron workers, everybody under the sun is blocking the entrance to, or the exit, actually, to the Mound Road plant, so that the Sunday New York, it was on a Saturday, I guess it was, so the Sunday New York Time, or I'm not gave it, the Sunday Detroit News and Free Press could not get out. And then, so across the street, massing are a couple hundred police as well. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. There were hundreds of strikers there and hundreds of police that were brought in from police departments from all over metropolitan Detroit, really. So it really was extraordinary. And, you know, I described how the police used pepper gas and then ultimately tear gas in ways that really violated the strikers' rights.
Well, you know, one thing you, Chris Romberg, you mentioned clash. Usually I tell people when you see something in the newspaper, demonstrators clash with police, it means that the cops kicked the crap out of some demonstrators wearing flip-flops and shorts, you know. But here you had big, strong, working-class guys, many of whom were neighbors, on both sides of, you know, the line. You know, sometimes then they're all Sterling Heights residents. I mean, sometimes these strikers would be yelling at individual cops, you know, "Hey, Jim, what the hell are you doing?" And, you know, calling them out by name. And in your book, you have the broken table. You very nicely have this description of this pepper spraying and one guy who was just standing there. And I remember him. I saw that he was wearing only cut off Levi's shorts and work boots. And the cops had these big foggers, not these little cans like, you know, they use on the Occupy demonstration, but these huge containers of this stuff, and they were spraying it directly on him, and the guy would not move. He was an iron worker, which did it, yeah.
Yeah, well, there were several lawsuits, of course, that came out of this about police misconduct. Most of those were settled out of court or thrown out, but one of them actually did go to trial and reached a verdict. And in that case, a federal jury found that the city of Sterling Heights, its police officers, and the newspaper agency were actually guilty of conspiracy to deprive the strikers of their civil rights.
Well, having been there, I've got about 1,000 things to say, but you're my guest, and I've already taken up too much time, and we're getting close to the end of my show. So people may wonder, in The Broken Table, your book, The Detroit Newspaper Strike and the State of American Labor, who won?
Well, I don't think anybody won. You know, it was enormously expensive. You can't say the newspapers really won because they dropped an awful lot of money, and the strike went on for 5 years, actually. There was 19 months of strike and then several years of litigation after that. And let me just say this. And the argument I make in the book is that it's a failure of law, that basically the law has been turned upside down. Even though workers have a right to strike in this country, decades of judicial decisions and NLRB precedents have eroded that right. So that, in effect, nowadays we don't really have a right to strike, and I think that's a bad outcome. But that's a policy decision. That's not something that's written, into the law of nature or anything. It's not because of globalization or technology. It's a policy decision that we have now about, you know, what kind of rights workers have. so that, you know, if we wanted to, we could have different policy. I just want to call attention to this, and that the decline of unionization, I think, has been very harmful for the economy and the society as a whole. But an essential part of that is the decline of workers' rights on the job.
Well, we're almost back to the 1920s, and people ascribe our right to strike and our right to unionize to Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, and that's when it got enshrined into law. But really, what caused it was the incredible militancy of the unionization movement among the rank and file in the beginning of the early 1930s. So the state of American labor today is kind of dismal, isn't it?
We're in bad shape. We are, in effect, in a pre-New Deal era. It's gone that far back, you know. But that's not because of a high-tech economy or anything like that. You know, as I say, one of the interesting things here is that you had white-collar professionals, journalists, who were striking right alongside blue-collar workers. And I think what they saw was that they had just as many issues and concerns about losing autonomy on the job, you know, losing their professional status, that really speak to a lot of the issues that workers in white-collar or information economy types of jobs share the same kinds of issues.
In 60 seconds or less, are you optimistic about the state of American labor as we go forward?
Well, I think it's a big struggle, but I think it's a very important one. What I'm trying to do in the broken table is to show that this is an issue that really affects more than just a single group of workers, right? That every strike is not just about a handful of workers at a particular plant or shop, but it's really something that is a public issue that we should all be concerned about, that it affects both the larger economy and our democratic rights. So I'm not trying to bring everybody down with a story of bad news. What I'm trying to do is to show how important it is for us to be concerned about this.
And well done. Chris Romberg has been my guest. His book is The Broken Table, The Detroit Newspaper Strike and the State of American Labor. It's published by the Russell Sage Foundation. You go to russellsage.org, to my site, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Chris Romberg, thanks for your book.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF, everything that rocks. Night Call.
Hey, music lovers. Verizon Red Hot Deal Days are back. Get the Samsung Galaxy S3 Mini free. Verizon. Click the banner to buy now and get free overnight shipping. Requires new two-year activation. Early termination and other fees may apply.
Okay, I've got an amazing Christmas deal. Two words, Sherry's Berries. These gourmet berries are huge and freshly dipped in dark, white, and milk chocolatey deliciousness. Then they're covered in decadent toppings like chocolate chips and nuts. And get this right now, these mouthwatering gourmet berries start at $19.99. Plus, get double the berries for just $10 more. But you gotta hurry, Christmas is almost here, and this deal expires this Friday. The only way to get this amazing offer is to go to berries.com, click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, and enter secret code GLITTER.
Business owners, do you want to double your sales in 12 months? Chet Holmes International's track record for the past three decades speaks for itself. Our legendary founder and best-selling author of The Ultimate Sales Machine, Chet Holmes, explains.
Why does one person open a business and you go back 30 years later and basically they've made themselves a job, not a business? Another person opens up a business and in 10 years they have 60 locations and cash out a multimillionaire. The difference between the two is not the product or the service, folks. It's the skills and learning curve of the entrepreneur.
We've created a serious training program. 4 ways to double sales in 12 months. And we'll give this to any serious business owner who calls 800-936-0222. Leave us a voicemail with your email to get this powerful audio training program at our expense. Call right now. It's a heck of a gift. See if you agree. 800-936-0222. That's 800-936-0222. From Chet Holmes International to your success.
This is your Biotech Minute. Biotechnology, a big word for an area of cutting-edge science that is improving the world we live in. In health, biotech provides breakthrough therapies and treatments for devastating diseases like cancer, MS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and HIV/AIDS. Biotechnology is also helping farmers produce more crops from existing acreage, reducing fuel use and greenhouse gas emissions, and it's creating fuels from renewable green energy sources like algae and plant waste. And this is just the beginning. The biotechnology research being done in laboratories today will improve the health and quality of our lives and our world for generations that follow. Biotechnology, helping heal, fuel, and feed the world. A public service message from this station and the Biotechnology Industry Organization.
Now, 101 WRIF, everything that rocks.
Thank you.
RIF HD1 Detroit.
The 12 Days of Rhythmus are back. Keep listening for your next chance to win. Details online at WRIF.com.
Just let it go. Don't want to argue anymore. I can't be sure I know just what we're fighting for. I know you're scared and that you're thinking I may